soul. Like out of time in days of old. This funny feeling made it seem like I was caught inside a dream. As Pharaoh's laying down to sleep with riches, stones, and slaves to keep. I saw the Christians shed their blood.
Listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. As Christmas approaches, 350 UAW workers and their families are locked out of work at the CNH Case New Holland plant in Racine, Wisconsin. UAW Local 180 went on strike November 2nd over health insurance and other issues, but on November 22nd they announced an end to that strike. Management, though, won't let the workers return as long as a new contract remains unsettled. Local 180's Kevin Michkowski says it's gut-wrenching for he and fellow workers to have to watch replacement workers taking their jobs at Christmas time.
When strike replacement workers came in and started working while we were on, when we called the strike, and then to see them, you know, keep those individuals in there and see the faces of my members, it's really, really a sad time to see it, you know, because they're coming in there and then doing the work that we could do.
The AFL-CIO is asking the public to support the striking families by sending donations to UAW Local 180, 3323 Kearney Avenue in Racine, Wisconsin at 53403.
The Building Trades Union recently weighed in on the discussion revolving around the restructuring of the AFL-CIO. Edward Sullivan, president of the AFL-CIO's Building and Construction Trades Department, sent a letter to AFL-CIO President John Sweeney last week. In the letter, he encourages a self-examination of labor's future. However, he says it's reckless and irresponsible for individuals outside of the construction industry to take a one-size-fits-all approach to the future of the movement. Sullivan's letter comes in response to suggestions made by the SEIU and Teamsters for the future of the AFL-CIO.
New York Times has shined a national spotlight on a possible case of racial profiling and workplace discrimination. Two Shiite Muslims, Ali Akbar Afshari and Shala Afshari, were fired for national security reasons that remained secret. The Afsharis moved to the U.S. from Iran 18 years ago, and both were employees of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, a federal agency that studies workplace hazards. Alan Carlin is the lawyer representing Mr. and Mrs. Afshari.
Suddenly, one day earlier this year, they were called in and summarily fired, escorted off the premises, given no rights, and told only that they had failed a background check that they didn't even know they were being checked out on.
The Afsharis are asking the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services for back pay and reinstatement or the chance to appeal.
Here's today's Now a Bob report. Civilian satisfaction with services of the federal government reached an all-time high in 2004. According to the Customer Satisfaction Report published by the University of Michigan, the federal sector received an overall score of 72.1 out of 100. Claes Fornell, the professor who oversees the survey, says that shrinking government would make it more difficult to maintain the ranking. Courtesy and professionalism of government personnel is also at an all-time high. Health-related services continue to receive the highest scores.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
No, not the yacht.
Darling, wake up. You're having a nightmare.
Oh, it was terrible. Oh. I dreamed we lost our billions, and we were middle class.
There, there.
We were both working, and we could barely pay our bills. The children had to go to public schools. Oh. We had something called an HMO.
Oh, you poor thing.
It seems so real. We couldn't even afford my Botox.
Oh, sweetheart, go back to sleep. I'll write another campaign check tomorrow.
President George W. Bush, keeping alive the American dream for some of us.
Easily paid for by BillionairesForBush.com.
Time for another peek into the lifestyles of the rich and cranky.
Being rich really can be tough. Yes, you do get lots of stuff. Houses, cars, gadgets, games, gizmos, and other toys to keep you amused as you idle away your time. But then, you have all that stuff to deal with. Just keeping it dusted must be taxing. And of course, you keep buying more stuff because, well, you're rich. You can afford it. But then, you have more to deal with and, ah, what's a rich person to do? Of course, do what regular people do. Have a yard sale. This is precisely the solution that Caroline Kennedy came upon when she realized that she simply had too much stuff. In her own words, "I found myself again with more houses and belongings than I could possibly use or enjoy." Yes, Caroline, we can only imagine what a burden that must be. So, she's having a yard sale. Not literally, for wealthy neighbors would find it tacky beyond belief for the Kennedys to display their castaways on the lawn of the family compound at Hyannis Port. No, no, this will be done properly. An elite New York City auction house will handle the February sale of Caroline's stuff, and it is mostly just stuff. For sure, there are some special items and rare family photos of John F. Kennedy, but the bulk of the lot is much like what you'd put out for your yard sale. A fiberglass kitchen tray, some duck decoys, pieces and bits of a set of plain dinner dishes, a few dinged-up end tables, a pair of folding suitcase racks, and, get this, a bunch of mason jars. But while it is just stuff, it is Kennedy stuff, so Caroline's yard sale is expected to fetch a minimum of $1 million. Indeed, a special 380-page catalog of her stuff has been printed, and the catalog itself is tagged at $50 a copy. This is Jim Hightower saying, maybe the Kennedys need the money, but really, shouldn't she just have donated some of this stuff to Goodwill?
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
1 in 4 adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricidin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coricidin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coricidin HBP. Use as directed.
Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends. Tom Hartman here with you, where we run rings around the right wing every day. Broadcasting live from the People's Republic of Vermont. From behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone. It's I've got to do this as a conservative alert. This is just too much. Come on. There you go. Come on. Yep. G.W. Bush, his long-sought American taxpayer finance success in Iraq occurred this weekend. The first political party to hold a 3,000-member public rally in Baghdad this first week of campaigning for the January elections, the first political party to hold an official meeting. 3,000 members. A rally in Baghdad. This is the $100 billion, well, $126 or $8 billion so far, $200 billion by the end of this year, or by the end of the next fiscal year, by October of next year. The over $120 billion, this is what we've gotten for our money. I'm sure this is just going to make the Bushes so happy, the entire Bush family. The first political party to hold a 3,000-member public rally in Baghdad this week of campaigning was the 30-year-old Iraqi Communist Party. Yes, the Communist Party of Iraq going to get their place on the ballot. Amazing. some inspiring correspondence recently I want to share with you. By the way, welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here. We are broadcasting live on radio stations all across the country, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system. And for our Sirius listeners, by the way, I will be back on the air on Sirius this afternoon from 3 until 7 p.m. as on Air America Radio, filling in for Randy Rhodes in her program today, today and Wednesday of this week and next. And also, you know, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org with archives at whiterosesociety.org. And, of course, at tomhartman.com, Mike Toth got us a new set this last weekend, has the latest NLP lesson in it, and many other things. You can find those by going to tomhartman.com and clicking on the Listen to Archives, both the archives at Ben Birch's White Rose Society and also the ones on tomhartman.com. Very different kinds of archives. And also to get to our message board. Now some 50,000 messages there. Get to our live chat room hosted by the Democratic Forum on CompuServe. Just click live chat. It'll take you right over there. You can drop in. There's no charge or anything like that. Anyhow, inspiring feedback. This is the inspiring feed. This is the stuff that makes that causes me to know that we're doing the right thing. That there is hope. That people are getting it. That people are waking up, that people are actually taking the steps. You have heard me say before that the two most important forces that converted the American discontent with the East India Company's domination of our economy in the 1770s and the British stripping us of human and civil rights, those twin evils, a government out of control, and a corporation that was not only manipulating the government to its own benefit, but also was taking control of the economy. The anti-corporate revolt, of course, started in 1773 with the Boston Tea Party against the East India Company. Last week was the anniversary of it. And the revolt against the government itself that was supported by and a major stockholder in the East India Company against King George III, the third George to be president or to be king of England, not unlike, ironically, George W. Bush is the third George to be president of the United States. But we'll set that aside. That this revolt began in large part as a consequence of these twin irritations, but the thing that brought it out into the public sphere was an active and aggressive behind-the-scenes campaign. It's the same thing that happened in the Ukraine. I wrote about it in an article I wrote for Common Dreams a couple of weeks ago called How to Take Back a Stolen Election, which you can find. You go to tomhartman.com and click on Articles on Democracy. You'll find it there, where a small group, as I recall, it was like six or eight people, had actually come over from Serbia to do this because they'd done it successfully in Serbia. They had done it successfully in Georgia. They had tried it in Belarus and failed. Georgia, the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. And they just did it successfully in the Ukraine. This small group of people came over and they led this campaign to expose a corrupt election. Well, that small group of people in the 1770s were pamphleteers and committees of correspondence. And without them, there would not have been an American Revolution. The pamphleteers, under cover of darkness at night, because if the British caught them, they would shoot them, or arrest them anyway. The pamphleteers would go out at night and they'd put up pamphlets all over the place saying, you know, the detestable East India Company, look what they're doing, the British, look what they're... Pamphleteers, every few days there'd be a new pamphlet starting. This really started to pick up around 1772. It led to the Tea Party in 1773. It was almost every other day there was a new pamphlet out. I have copies of a lot of these things. There are people who collect these things. I don't have any of the originals, but the, you know, you can find the copies around. And I quote actually a lot of them in my books, What Would Jefferson Do? And in Unequal Protection. So there's the pamphleteers. Then there was the committees of correspondence. Committees of correspondence, back in those days, it was mostly women. And they don't get anywhere near enough credit for the American Revolution, because without them, it wouldn't have happened. And what happened was that these women got together, by mostly, as I say, mostly, there were some men involved in this, but it was mostly women. They got together in groups, and back then there were sewing circles and reading circles and social circles and things like that, and they were called that. I actually, when we moved up to here to Vermont, I was invited to speak in this in a little town in Vermont at the ladies' sewing circle. And there were, I don't know, 20? I was going to say 30. I don't think it could have been that many. 20 or so women there. Probably three-quarters of them were over 50. Probably half of them were over 70. And then there was a half a dozen who were under 30 or 40. And what they did is they got together every week, and they would sit and sew and talk about politics. And every month they read a book, and they would discuss that book throughout the week. And, you know, when they, I was invited to speak at the ladies' sewing circle, and I thought, well, this is kind of, you don't hear this language very often. Turns out, this group in this town had been founded over 150 years ago and was still running. So anyhow, they would get together and they would write letters to the editors of the newspapers, these committees of correspondence. And the committees of the correspondents and the pamphleteers were the ones who converted discontent into revolution. Just like in the Ukraine, these kids with the internet, their weblogs, and their demonstrations brought people out into the streets. It's the same thing that happened with the anti-don't invade Iraq demonstrations all over the United States, all over the world, the largest demonstrations in history. So anyhow, this is when you know you're doing something right. I get this in the mail. This is from Alan the Trucker, a regular listener to the program. Hey, Alan, if you're listening. He says, thanks to listening to you and getting ideals, I wrote this and had it published in both of my local papers. Isn't this cool? This guy submits this thing to both his local papers, and they both printed it. And I just have to read it to you. This is Alan. One of our serious listeners, a trucker, Sirius Satellite Radio, Alan the Trucker, he wrote this piece and got it published. And you see this, you can do this too. Anyhow, here it is. Middle class under attack and losing. Starting with the first term of Ronald Reagan, there's been a war on the middle class in this country. These new conservatives started this war and now they are winning. Their open agenda is to put this country into so much debt that they can then let corporations take over government. Cheap labor is the main goal of their corporate sponsors. This separates them from traditional Republicans such as Eisenhower, who fought for the middle class. The original reason we declared our independence from Great Britain was not because of a tax increase. It was because of tax cuts given to the East India Company. This British company was into everything from renting ships to real estate and had close ties to King George. These unfair tax cuts for King George's buddies were harming hundreds of small businesses along our East Coast. In a similar story, the last 25 years, big retail stores have been getting tax advantages over smaller stores due to political payoffs. Also, because of the dropping of trade tariffs, they're getting cheap labor at the expense of American middle-class workers. I think it's time for middle-class workers to unionize and have another Boston-style Tea Party. This is brilliant. This is absolutely brilliant. Hats off to you, Alan. I'm so pleased. And then, oddly, I was just reading the paper Saturday here in central Vermont, and in the Montpelier paper, the Montpelier Times Argus. This is a town of 8,900 people. It's the state capital, but it's fairly small. The only state capital in the United States with no McDonald's. That's not just because we're small. That's because whenever they try and bring one in, we sue them. But that's a whole other story. Anyway, time to stage a local tea party. This is by Edward Kentish in Calais. I don't know this guy. He doesn't listen to our program. It's just a local guy. Calais is the, it's not Calais, it's Calais. Okay, I'm a Vermonter. The next town over. And he says, Thursday was the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party, a historic moment triggering events leading to the founding of the United States of America. And what was the Boston Tea Party? How is it relevant to Central Vermont? The Tea Party was not a strike against the British Crown. It was a strike against a British corporation, the East India Company. The East India Company was a predecessor of today's transnational corporations, dominating trade from China to the Caribbean, including nearly all trade to and from North America. And then he goes on through the whole thing about, you know, how it caused wars, addiction, famine, and widespread suffering. And then on December 16th in Boston, over 2,000 people said enough. They threw off the company. It was 2,000, I'm not sure where he got the 2,000 number. It was quite a few who met in Faneuil Hall. It was 150, according to George Robert 12-Tree Hughes, who was the actual witness of the event. He was actually there, and he wrote the only written record of what happened at the Boston Tea Party. It was published by A.J. Bliss in 1838, 50 years after the Boston Tea Party, because they had all vowed this 50-year oath of silence in Oswego, New York. He published the thing. It's been out of print for 150 years. Anyway, it says, once again we face transnational corporations that destroy communities and the environment in their search for profits. See, you can write this stuff and you can get it published in your local newspapers. Good on you. Good on you, Alan, and good on you, Edward. 20 after.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
This year, give a Christmas gift of inner peace, mental health, and transformation in the form of a fun, beautiful game you play with your body and brain based on meditation, breathing, and biofeedback. Go to opednews.com to click on the Wild Divine banner to order the game that Yoga Journal says turns the quest for calm into entertainment. In most games, you find weapons. With Wild Divine, you connect your computer to your body and play the game with your mind, heart, and breath. So you find new abilities and awareness truly within yourself that you use to win the game and then apply in your real life. PC Magazine says Wild Divine is innovative and fun, and even better, it's very effective. And they give it 5 stars. It's shipped with both Windows and Mac software.
The Wild Divine game is a great Christmas gift that will make a real difference in a person's life. Go to opednews.com now and click on the Wild Divine banner to order it in time for Christmas. That's opednews.com. If you sell a product or service, we have listeners from coast to coast and in 97 countries who want to know about you. Reach out to our national audience with our small business advertising package. You'll pay just a fraction of what national advertising usually costs. Call now at 802-229-2288 or visit our website, tomhartman.com, and follow the links to the small business advertising package for more information. Don't miss reaching a national audience now. 802-229-2288. Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza Man.
Hey, you're not the Pizza Man. You're the cable guy again.
Price Patrol.
No, you're not. I can see your van. You're the cable company. I'm not going to let you raise my rates again. I'm calling American Satellite to get a DirecTV system.
Presidential candidate.
Are you going to offer me over 125 digital quality channels for as little as $39.99 a month, including my local channels?
Ice Cream Man.
Yeah, like that's going to work. If I call American Satellite right now, I can get a 4-room DirecTV system, including professional installation free. Can you beat that?
Pizza Man.
You already tried that. Well, that's it. I'm calling to get my DirecTV system.
Call 800-505-1546. That's 800-505-1546. For new customers only. Annual programming commitment required. Ask how you can get your first 6 months for only $29.99 a month of $60 value. Offer ends July 17th. Call now. 800-505-1546.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzled them. You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate. Gave them the old hocus pocus. You misdirected them.
And welcome back.
With 9/11 and Saddam Hussein.
Oh, what a great song.
You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them. Let those blue states complain.
There you go. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. There was another little Bushism in there, but I missed it. Anyhow, 1-866-889-8894. Our phone number, TomHartman.com. The website. If you want to post to our message board, you can get over there. And from time to time, I read things from the message board as well. The question for our first hour, how can we have a democracy without a middle class? Going to get into that. I've got a rush alert for you. Economic hitman is going to be a guest in the second hour of our program. Guy who wrote the book called The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, How Empire Uses Business, the American Empire specifically. In the third hour of our program, what are the risks of the El Zarqawi myth? Myth? There's a myth about El Zarqawi? We'll get into that in our third hour. And then later on the day, why is the Bush administration willing to kill us softly with energy policy and whatnot? Why do the cons want to destroy the ACLU? We're going to be talking about centrism and corporate profits over life. It's going to be an interesting day. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Warren in Mississippi is with us. Hey, Warren, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, it's great to talk to you. I just had to call you with this because I've come up with two solutions to two of the biggest problems in America today.
Okay, great, Warren.
And they work. When you really think this through, it works because it has historical precedent. Okay, problem number one, immigration. We all know that people from all over the world want to come to America, will do anything to get here. Immigrate or come into the country illegally, and it's a big problem.
Well, there's a slight qualifier on that. That is not true of most of the people in Western Europe and in Scandinavia. It's true of the people of the Third World. But, yeah, I agree with you.
But lots of people, wherever they may be from.
Five out of the planet's 6 billion people.
And Bush is saying, look, let's bring these people in if they want to work. And you know what? I agree with that. So this is what I suggest. The other problem that we have is that more and more Americans do not want to join the military. I mean, they are not going to be able to get the military up to speed because who wants to go over and fight in Iraq?
Warren, if your suggestion is let's let immigrants come in and join the military and give them citizenship as a reward for that, they're already doing that.
You're kidding.
No, they're already doing that. In fact, Bush showed up at a ceremony about 3 or 4 months ago where about 50 or 60 Iraq war vets, people who had been in Iraq, many of them wounded, were actually given citizenship for their service to the United States in the Army in Iraq. It's already being done.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that with the Mexicans?
I know. In fact, I saw the thing on TV, and an awful lot of them looked Hispanic. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's already being done. Your idea was so good that Karl Rove already thought of it.
Well, it has historical precedence because kings of other nations, you know, going back hundreds of years ago, used to hire poor people.
Oh,
to
sure,
for them.
Sure. And it was one of the ways in Athens, for example, the Greeks, if a slave wanted to become a citizen, they could do it through military service. It was one of, in fact, predictable.
It all comes around again, Tom.
Yep. Here we are. Empire revisiting empire. Like it's like a dog chasing its tail or something. Good
Thanks
point,
so
Warren.
For your show. Love to listen to you.
Thank you. I'm pleased that you are. A program without listeners ain't a program. I really do appreciate it, Warren. Thanks for the call. 1-866-889-8894. A telephone number. Some information from Cliff Arnebeck. I want to share with you after the break about what's going on in Ohio. 29 minutes past the hour.
Mom, I can't believe you asked Rick all those questions. Where do you live? And who are your parents? It's so embarrassing.
Getting to know your kid's friends isn't easy. But if you don't, he's more likely to do drugs.
Geez, you have to know everything?
Actually, Sean, I do.
Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for Drug-Free America.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. As Christmas approaches, 350 UAW workers and their families are locked out of work at the CNH Case New Holland plant in Racine, Wisconsin. UAW Local 180 went on strike November 2nd over health insurance and other issues, but on November 22nd they announced an end to that strike. Management, though, won't let the workers return as long as a new contract remains unsettled. Local 180's Kevin Michkowski says it's gut-wrenching for he and fellow workers to have to watch replacement workers taking their jobs at Christmas time.
When strike replacement workers came in and started working while we were on, when we called the strike, and then to see them, you know, keep those individuals in there and see the faces of my members, it's really, really a sad time to see it, you know, because they're coming in there and then doing the work that we could do.
The AFL-CIO is asking the public to support the striking families by sending donations to UAW Local 180, 3323 Kearney Avenue in Racine, Wisconsin at 53403.
The Building Trades Union recently weighed in on the discussion revolving around the restructuring of the AFL-CIO. Edward Sullivan, president of the AFL-CIO's Building and Construction Trades Department, sent a letter to AFL-CIO President John Sweeney last week. In the letter, he encouraged a self-examination of labor's future. However, he says it's reckless and irresponsible for individuals outside of the construction industry to take a one-size-fits-all approach to the future of the movement. Sullivan's letter comes in response to suggestions made by the SEIU and Teamsters for the future of the AFL-CIO.
New York Times has shined a national spotlight on a possible case of racial profiling and workplace discrimination. Two Shiite Muslims, Ali Akbar Afshari and Shala Afshari, were fired for national security reasons that remain secret. The Afsharis moved to the U.S. from Iran 18 years ago, and both were employees of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, a federal agency that studies workplace hazards. Alan Carlin is the lawyer representing Mr. and Mrs. Afshari.
Suddenly, one day earlier this year, they were called in and summarily fired, escorted off the premises, given no rights, and told only that they had failed a background check that they didn't even know they were being checked out on.
The Afsharis are asking the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services for back pay and reinstatement or the chance to appeal.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Civilian satisfaction with services of the federal government reached an all-time high in 2004. According to the Customer Satisfaction Report published by the University of Michigan, the federal sector received an overall score of 72.1 out of 100. Claes Fornell, the professor who oversees the survey, says that shrinking government would make it more difficult to maintain the ranking. Courtesy and professionalism of government personnel is also at an all-time high. Health-related services continue to receive the highest scores.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Hey, ho, 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 and the bottles of rum. Santa's run off to the Caribbean. He thinks of
about cold drinks and fun in the sun. Ho, 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 and a bottle of rum.
Well, I'd have no objections to the Caribbean right now. It was, I think it was 16 degrees below zero last night here in the People's Republic of Vermont. We're high up in the mountains. We're up in the Green Mountains. It is, there's, what do they call them, snow flowers? There's frost in the windows where the, between the window and the storm window leaks a little bit of air, you know, and I'm looking out on the forest, actually. I'm looking at a forest right now and through the window, and there's all this, these ice crystals. It's actually quite beautiful. But boy, is it cold! Anyhow, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Let's go to Phil in Tampa, Florida, and see what's on his mind. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program.
Hi. Well, it's not quite that cold in Florida, but it's cold for us. I don't think it's going to get warmer than 56.
Oh, gee. I'm not working up a whole lot of sympathy for you, Phil. I'm
sorry. but you know something. You know, most of the time it's like 85 and 80% humidity.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't live in Florida.
So it's a real change. I mean, 6 weeks ago, when I saw sweaters in my dresser, I kind of laughed. Like, what am I going to do with those things?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. When you're so inundated with the heat and the humidity, you never think it could ever change.
Well, every now and then, you guys even get frost down there. So, but that's not what you call it,
no.
Is it?
You know, they like to call the internet or Drudge likes to call the internet, you know, the alternative media. But here's a very important story that he wouldn't publish because I presented to him a number of times. And it's regarding Gary Webb, former reporter. Did you hear about this?
Yeah, who died, who committed suicide, actually. There was a bit of a buzz for a while that he had been murdered, that there were multiple gunshot wounds.
Yeah, how do you put two bullets in your head?
Well, it turns out that it wasn't two bullets. And in fact, his wife has come out.
Ex-wife has come out in
apparently a press conference. I did read a couple of follow-up stories on this and said that he had been talking about this for some time. It was apparently well-planned. He put a note on the outside of the door that said, that, you know, don't come in, call an ambulance, because he didn't want somebody to come in and find his, you know, gruesome body. This was just a suicide. The guy was depressed. He was depressive. So,
well, I think
it's a tragedy.
CIA told anybody, you know, put him on the you know, blacklist of the guy so he couldn't get work.
Yeah, I don't know. You know,
this goes back to the interesting thing is that Kerry held subcommittee hearings and exposed how the Contras backhauled cocaine.
Yeah,
and he never brought it up in his run for the White House.
I know. There was a lot that Kerry did, very, very noble and powerful and good stuff in the Senate that never got raised in the run for the White House.
What was he thinking?
Well, you know, I don't want to try and second guess the Kerry campaign. And with regard to Webb, just to you know, finish that thought, another one of the reasons why I'm not certain that there is a conspiracy here is because the people in this country who do have the responsibility and the ability to kill people don't do it in ways that anybody's scratching their head about. I mean, you know, it's just, they're pros. And what they call wet operations. And so, you know, generally when there is some question or when it looks like it might have been something other than what it was, it wasn't. You know, and when, on the other hand, they've got agents, there are chemicals out there that'll give a person cancer in a few weeks. I mean, there's things that will cause it to look like people have gone into you know, diabetic shock. I mean, there's so many ways to kill people that the CIA and the KGB have perfected that they don't need to do clunky stuff like, you know, staging suicides. That's, you know, and when the mob kills somebody, they do it publicly and they brag about it. So it's, you know, it's, I think it was just a tragedy, frankly, is my opinion. I may be wrong.
I found another article that the coroner was now thinking it was murder.
Yeah, well, keep me up to date on it. I mean, maybe what I have is not the last word.
Because I just don't think it's possible to put two bullets in your head. Because you put one bullet in your head, you're not going to be alive to pull the trigger the second time.
Well, it depends on where you put the first bullet. I mean, if you put it in some place that merely hurts a whole lot, you might have an even stronger incentive to pull the trigger the second time. I just don't know. You know, I had these same thoughts when the Chicago 7 guy who was writing a piece for Playboy outing the Bush family, and he was found suicided in a hotel room.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm spacing his name right now, but I have, to this day, doubts about that one. But again, my own advice to myself is, you know, if it looks like suicide, it probably is, because you know, these guys have ways of just making, you know, of discrediting people, destroying people, whatever you want. I mean, child pornography on their computers. There's just a million ways to get people out of the way that won't raise eyebrows, that will cause people to go, yeah, that guy was a son of a guy. But who knows?
Before I let you, before you go,
sure.
What did you think of Saturday Night Live kicking old Limbo in the with his drug addiction? Did you see this? You hear about the skit?
I didn't see it. You know, I recorded it. I haven't seen it yet. So.
Yeah, they did a skit, kind of a cartoon skit about Limbaugh, and then showed him on the floor with pills and stuff like that.
Interesting. Well, we've got a Limbaugh alert coming up today, so
you'll
appreciate that. Phil, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. I do appreciate it, and we'll talk to you again. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Alfred in Wyoming, Michigan on the line. Hey, Alfred.
Yeah, Tom, I don't know whether here in Grand Rapids we get your second hour or first hour or what.
You get the first and second hour of a three-hour program.
Oh, okay. The reason I'm calling is that I think it was Friday. You weren't quite sure where Henry Wallace was from, the state of Iowa.
Oh, well, thank you.
And he was his dad, and he had a agricultural magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a registered Republican, but he was a New Dealer, and that's what Roosevelt was hoping to get, a liberal party versus a conservative party. And Nance Garner ran twice as Roosevelt's.
Was that John Nance Garner?
Yeah, John Nance Garner at 32 and 36, and then Wallace became the nominee in 40, and, of course, Truman in 44.
I see.
Mainly because a lot of people, the regular party people, were a little disenchanted with Wallace, also the fact that he hadn't been a lifelong Democrat.
Yeah, so Roosevelt brought Wallace on because he was a Republican and he was trying to balance the ticket, or
yeah, he had him as Secretary of Agriculture, I believe.
Prior to that, why didn't John Nance Garner run for the third term?
Oh, well, there were thoughts about him running in 1940, but he was pretty old by then. He was from Texas and he was pretty much of a real Dixiecrat.
Uh-huh.
Before there were Dixiecrats.
I see. And so there was friction between him and Roosevelt, and he was getting older, and he wanted to go back to Texas and all those things together.
Yeah, and Roosevelt. And funny part, too, is something that I read recently, The Fox and the Lion, that said that if it hadn't been for the fact that the war in Europe was approaching, the United States, people were sure that we were going to get involved, that Roosevelt was five, without that indication, Roosevelt, Wilkie would have beaten Roosevelt by 5%, because people were becoming disenchanted with the New Deal and the fact that he wanted a third term.
Well, and don't discount Father Coughlin in that equation.
Yeah, I think he was pretty well shot by then, though, wasn't he?
You know, I don't remember what year they pulled him off the air. It was either the very late 30s or the very early 40s, because it was just before we went into the war, and he had shifted into his anti-war, anti-Semitic, rants. And
but I thought I'd bring that to your attention. He was from Iowa.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Okay. Thanks,
Alfred. Thank you. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, and thanks for the update. It's always good to find out these things. And now our Rush alert for the day.
Sending crimes, making money, selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts.
Hates his guts.
I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic guts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do. And I've told you this. They always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
Yeah, that's our... Limbo Alert theme music.
That's right. You're being scared.
The Limbo Alert for the day here is Rush actually shared with us a little bit of truth, and a significant bit of truth, and I think it's important to share with my listeners as well. Here he is in his own voice.
So what? Get over it. Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Interesting. interesting. His policies may live on, but we are in the process of doing something about that as well. Roosevelt, you'll remember, brought us minimum wage laws, brought us the Wagner Act, the right to unionize, brought us Social Security, I believe brought us the early predecessor to Medicare, brought us public works projects like the TVA and so on, the involvement of government in bringing electricity and bringing telephone service to people. And we're in the process of taking care of that, too.
Get over it! Roosevelt is dead! His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And here's another step in doing something about that. Adam Cohen writes in the Editorial Observer, what's new in a legal world? A growing campaign to undo the New Deal. The New Deal made an unexpected appearance at the Supreme Court recently in the form of a 1942 case about wheat. It's a case called Wickard versus Filburn. And let's go back to what he said, what Adam Cohen's saying. In the early 1900s, justices routinely struck down laws protecting workers and discouraging child labor. The way that they did this, by the way, was they said that the Interstate Commerce Clause in the Constitution, which gives the federal government the ability to regulate commerce among and between the states, could apply to a business within a state. And here's how it worked in the Wickard versus Filmer case, Filburn case. In the Wickard versus Filburn case, Wickard was growing wheat, and he was consuming his own wheat. He was selling some of it locally, but none of it went into interstate commerce. It wasn't being sold across state lines. And yet the federal government, as part of the New Deal, part of trying to bring farmers out of absolute poverty, the Roosevelt administration had stepped in and they were messing in the marketplace, you know, in a way that conservatives would find horrible today. And perhaps some liberals, who knows? I mean, this is something that's arguable, but nonetheless, they were in there participating in the marketplace and setting price thresholds for wheat and, you know, trying to control the wheat supply. Here it is. Roscoe Filburn was, I'm sorry, I said it was Wickard. Roscoe Filburn was a farmer who argued that his wheat crop should not fall under federal production quotas because much of it was consumed on his own farm. In other words, you couldn't overgrow wheat, apparently. The Supreme Court held that even if that wheat, if Filburn's wheat, did not enter interstate commerce, wheat grown for use on a farm altered supply and demand in the national market. The decision gave Congress the broad power to regulate things that are located in one state, like factories and employer-employee relationships. This was a major case because what this case said was that because even though this was limited to one state, the supply of wheat, that wheat was fungible, that it affected the entire U.S. supply, and therefore, and basically it provided a precedent for the federal government to stick its nose in the business of folks within states. And a lot of people don't like that. And in some regards, you know, there are a lot of us who say, well, in some regards, it has been abused. But the ones who don't like it the most are the ones who don't like federal laws that regulate that allow unions to form within a state. Federal laws that require that states comply with federal minimum wage standards, even if the business doesn't operate in more than one state. Conservatives say that this is a violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause and of the old Federalist principle that the federal government would be weak and the state governments would be strong. States' rights. You know, basically looking at the Ninth and Tenth Amendments of the United States and suggesting that individual rights and states' rights preempt everything else. And there's a strong argument to be made for that, by the way. And yet, what we have decided and what the Supreme Court decided in this 1937 Wickard versus Filburn case was that the rights of society, the right to live in a society where there is a middle class, are also important. And so now we have a situation where the federal laws, anti-discrimination laws, for example, again, Wickard versus Filburn was a case that the segregationists in the South cited. And they said if this case hadn't happened, then then Florida could still refuse to serve black people in restaurants that were white only, for example. You know, if that restaurant is only owned within the state of Florida, the federal government has no business messing with it. That was their position. And the New Deal came along, and a good part of the New Deal was this whole thing of you know, the federal government involving itself in our lives, in the lives of people at the level of the state, in ways that hopefully made things better, that helped create a middle class in the United States. And sure enough, it actually did. But the conservative, I mean, it did create the middle class. And the conservatives are saying, but, you know, if a company doesn't do business in more than one state, it shouldn't be covered by the Commerce Clause. And so they should be able to pollute all they want. Let the state deal with it. If some, you know, schools, education, I mean, this cuts right across the board, all these different areas. Environmental protections, labor protections, OSHA standards, occupational health and safety standards. They say these shouldn't apply to companies if they only do business in one state. The attacks on the post-1937 view of the Constitution are becoming more mainstream among Republicans. One of President Bush's nominees to the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, Janice Rogers Brown, has called that case the Revolution of 1937. And there are conferences, for example. They call this thing the Constitutional in Exile, right? Conferences like Rolling Back the New Deal. And in papers like Was the New Deal Constitutional? Should Congress have the right to force employers to participate, for example, in Social Security, if they only do business in one state? And it looks like there's going to be a big challenge against Wickard versus Filburn. We're going to go back to 1920, 10 minutes before the hour.
Bonjour. My name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
Efforts to control air pollution go back several centuries, according to a new book. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Ice cores drilled from Greenland show that air pollution began when humans started smelting copper and iron thousands of years ago. But it didn't become a public issue until the 18th century, when citizen groups formed in London to fight air so black and dirty it made people sick. Joe Sherman says the fight for cleaner air became part of a morality and justice-based movement in England, which then spread to some U.S. cities by the late 18th century.
It was unjust for a lot of people in poor economic circumstances, the same way it is now. It's in a lot of ways, if not changed at all.
Sherman is the author of a new book called Gasp, The Swift and Terrible Beauty of Air. He traces people's views of air from Egyptian mythology to the present, and he examines how air pollution grew as a public issue. For example, smog began to evoke concern in the 1930s, in Los Angeles, of course. Sherman says L.A. then saw a huge industrial buildup in the 1940s to meet the military needs of a country at war, and the city's love affair with the automobile took off in the post-war boom. By the 1950s, people were protesting L.A.'s poor air quality.
L.A. was like the canary in the coal mine for the rest of the world because the same conditions gradually started to creep all over the place. So we have smog initially in L.A., but then as the automobile culture spread around the world and you had more and more emissions on a large daily basis surrounding cities, you had smog spreading everywhere.
Smog, mostly made up of ground-level ozone, is a public health problem in cities around the world. And it continues to plague Los Angeles. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Her newborn baby's wailing like a moaning dove. An old man with a broken teeth, stranded without love. Do I understand your question, man? Is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
And the New Deal did provide us with shelter from the storm for a while, but As Adam Cohen notes, if the Supreme Court drifts rightward in the next 4 years, it seems likely it could not only roll back Congress's Commerce Clause powers, but also revive other dangerous doctrines. Before 1937, the court invoked liberty of contract to strike down a Nebraska law regulating the weight of bread loaves, which kept buyers from being cheated, and a New York law setting a maximum 10-day workday. In pre-1937 America, workers were exploited, factories were free to pollute, and old people were generally poor when they retired. This is not an agenda the public would be likely to sign on to today if it were debated in an election, but conservatives, who like to complain about activist liberal judges, could achieve their New Deal, their anti-New Deal agenda, through judicial activism on the right. Judges could use the so-called Constitution in exile to declare workplace safety, environmental protection, and civil rights unconstitutional. What do you think about that, Raymond, in Cement City, Michigan?
Well, Tom, I think that that hits a underlying principle to your discussion that that you need to have tariffs in trade. And let me tell you how that connects. Is because what it does is when you have borders where you have different regulations and standards of commerce and activity in the society that have different rules and regulations on either side of the border, is that the only way you can control that is with tariffs. Just like all the, let me point out an example. Taft-Hartley, when that came across.
Yeah, I was just thinking of that. That's when the southern states essentially became China.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what happens when with WTO, you open it up and it only will work if the WTO also included negotiated situations where all the countries who were within that trading area had essentially the same rules, a compatible tax policy.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. We have to, you know, the David Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage assumes all those things and assumes that manufacturers have unique advantages, and just ain't so in the world anymore. You're absolutely right, Raymond. Raymond, we got a boogie. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. You're absolutely right, and the solution is to go back to what we did for over 200 years in the United States, and that is specifically have tariffs. We actually still do on many things, but for example, on the 31st of December this year, our tariffs on furniture and textiles are going to go away. The last ones. Expect to see those last jobs in America vanish. It's the Tom Hartman program here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. As Christmas approaches, 350 UAW workers and their families are locked out of work at the CNH Case New Holland plant in Racine, Wisconsin. UAW Local 180 went on strike November 2nd over health insurance and other issues, but on November 22nd they announced an end to that strike. Management, though, won't let the workers return as long as a new contract remains unsettled. Local 180's Kevin Michkowski says it's gut-wrenching for he and fellow workers to have to watch replacement workers taking their jobs at Christmas time.
When strike replacement workers came in and started working while we were on, when we called the strike, and then to see them, you know, keep those individuals in there and see the faces of my members, it's really, really a sad time to see it, you know, because they're coming in there and then doing the work that we could do.
The AFL-CIO is asking the public to support the striking families by sending donations to UAW Local 180, 3323 Kearney Avenue in Racine, Wisconsin at 53403.
The Building Trades Union recently weighed in on the discussion revolving around the restructuring of the AFL-CIO. Edward Sullivan, president of the AFL-CIO's Building and Construction Trades Department, sent a letter to AFL-CIO President John Sweeney last week. In the letter, he encourages a self-examination of labor's future. However, he says it's reckless and irresponsible for individuals outside of the construction industry to take a one-size-fits-all approach to the future of the movement. Sullivan's letter comes in response to suggestions made by the SEIU and Teamsters for the future of the AFL-CIO.
New York Times has shined a national spotlight on a possible case of racial profiling and workplace discrimination. Two Shiite Muslims, Ali Akbar Afshari and Shala Afshari, were fired for national security reasons that remained secret. The Afsharis moved to the U.S. from Iran 18 years ago, and both were employees of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, a federal agency that studies workplace hazards. Alan Carlin is the lawyer representing Mr. and Mrs. Afshari.
Suddenly, one day earlier this year, they were called in and summarily fired, escorted off the premises, given no rights, and told only that they had failed a background check that they didn't even know they were being checked out on.
The Afsharis are asking the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services for back pay and reinstatement or the chance to appeal.
Here's today's Now a Bob Report. Civilian satisfaction with services of the federal government reached an all-time high in 2004. According to the Customer Satisfaction Report published by the University of Michigan, the federal sector received an overall score of 72.1 out of 100. Claes Fornell, the professor who oversees the survey, says that shrinking government would make it more difficult to maintain the ranking. Courtesy and professionalism of government personnel is also at an all-time high. Health-related services continue to receive the highest scores.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
No, not the yacht.
Darling, wake up. You're having a nightmare.
Oh, it was terrible. Oh. I dreamed we lost our billions, and we were middle class.
There, there.
We were both working, and we could barely pay our bills. The children had to go to public schools. Oh. We had something called an HMO.
Oh, you poor thing.
It seems so real. We couldn't even afford my Botox.
Oh, sweetheart, go back to sleep. I'll write another campaign check tomorrow.
President George W. Bush, keeping alive the American dream. For some of us.
Easily paid for by BillionairesForBush.com.
One thing we learned from the recent unpleasantness, otherwise known as the presidential election, is that folks in the red states live lives centered around family values that are stronger and fundamentally more moral than the liberal lifestyles of those blue state people in, say, Massachusetts, right? The political pundits insist that this regional morality gap explains George W.'s red state victory and has altered American politics for the foreseeable future. Democrats, they say, are hopelessly out of touch with the deep family values practiced by born-again Christians in the South and Midwestern heartland. Interesting if true, but quick, name the state with the lowest divorce rate in the nation. It's the very state that Bush, the Pat Robertson-style political preachers, and others on the ultra-right constantly denounce as the absolute nadir of decadent liberalism, Massachusetts. Its divorce rate is barely half that of Georgia's home state of Texas, for example. Nor is Massachusetts some sort of statistical anomaly. The region with the lowest rate of family breakups in America is the Northeast, including such blue-blue states as New York, New Jersey, Maine, and lefty-crunchy Vermont. The highest rates are, in of all places, the Bible Belt, where you still see billboards piously proclaiming, "The family that prays together stays together." George Barna, a born-again Christian and the head of a research group that does surveys among faith groups, finds that only 19% of Northeasterners have divorced, compared to 27% of Southerners and Midwesterners. Barna's surveys also revealed another surprise. The divorce rate among conservative Christians is much higher than for other faith groups. 27% of born-again Christians have been divorced, as opposed to 24% of other Christians, and holy moly, only 21% of atheists and agnostics. This is Jim Hightower saying, maybe the pundits should just quit trying to color code America.
One in four adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricetin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coricetin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coricetin HBP. Use as directed.
Your oldest has just turned driving age. Time to add them to your policy. So you get in your car, drive down to your insurance company. Hunt for a space, double park, get a parking ticket, get in a fight with the meter maid, get thrown in jail, meet a guy named Wally. Wait a minute. This is just a bad dream. You've got Geico. You don't have to drive anywhere. You can do all that car insurance stuff online. Oh, that was a close one.
Geico's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? Geico. Online at geico.com.
For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Economic hitmen, John Perkins writes, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. John Perkins should know, that says in the back of his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, he was an economic hitman, an EHM. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Tom.
Great to have you on. It's interesting, the one point of separation. Ehud Sperling is a good friend. Steve Larson is a good friend. And, what's his name out in Seattle who wrote...
when corporate. David Quarton is a good friend, and you, I suspect we have all these people in common.
Well, you've been a good friend of mine for a long time. At least I've really enjoyed your work and your books. We haven't met face to face, but I'm a great admirer of yours. So
yep.
it's wonderful to be on your show.
Well, thank you, John. And I enjoyed your book on the scar that you co-wrote that with Ehud, didn't you, or am I thinking of somebody else?
On the Schwa?
Yeah, the Schwa.
Yeah. Well, Ehud published it. I co-wrote it with a Schwa whose name is Shakaim Mariana Chumbi, but Ehud wrote the introduction.
There you go.
It's a long introduction.
Yeah, and I wrote a blurb for that book, and I'm not sure if it ever made it to the book because I think I got it to Ehud after it was published. Anyhow.
Oh, well, I don't think I ever even saw that blurb.
No, thank you very much. Yeah. So anyhow, John Perkins, great to have you here. You've done some remarkable work. Your work in the Peace Corps. Your work with indigenous people in South America, doing not ecotourism, but socio-ecotourism, I suppose, taking people down there. I think a lot of people who are familiar with your work and your whole shape-shifting thing had no idea that you had spent 20-some-odd years from, I'm about 25 pages short of finishing your book here, so the last three nights I've been reading it, but you spent a whole lot of years working for this company, Maine. Is this company still around, John?
No, it was bought out. It was a closely held company, a partnership company that was bought out. The partners sold out in about 1984 to a very large construction engineering firm, which absorbed it into its own work.
Yeah, and so as an economic hitman, as an agent of this corporation, you were doing, you say, the work that in earlier, cruder, less sophisticated days was done by grandsons of presidents and, in one case in point, or government officials themselves, the work of empire, the work of entangling other countries in the interests
right.
of our nation, for example.
CIA agents, yes.
Yeah. And this work involved what?
Well, I think what you're mentioning here is Kermit Roosevelt, the first really economic hitman, who was a grandson of Teddy Roosevelt. And in the early 1950s, there was a democratically elected president of Iran, Mossadegh. And he was Time Magazine's Man of the Year. He was held out as the great hope for democracy around the world. But he went up against the oil companies. He insisted that they send more money back to the Iranian people than they had.
Well, didn't he threaten to nationalize the oil industry of Iran?
Yeah, so he set about nationalizing the oil industry, and this was unacceptable to us. We didn't dare send in the military because Iran bordered Russia, and both countries had thermonuclear weapons. So we sent in Kermit Roosevelt, who was a CIA agent with a few million dollars, and he managed to institute a coup that ultimately overthrew Mossadegh and replaced him with the Shah of Iran. So he was really the first economic hitman. But the problem was Kermit Roosevelt was a CIA agent. Had he been discovered, the government would have been implicated. So a decision was made shortly after that to continue to do this in the future. It was a great deal, a few million dollars, overthrow our government, but that in the future we would use private contractors. The CIA, the NSA might recruit these people and train them, but they would be working for private contractors.
Thus providing a layer of deniability, a layer of insulation, and plus a private corporation. You know, if Halliburton does something in Iraq, for example, there's not a congressional committee that can say, hey, you have to be transparent about this. We, the people, can't file a Freedom of Information Act filing against private contractors. This is perhaps why the second largest army in Iraq right now is private mercenaries, they don't call them mercenaries anymore. They call them contractors, but private security contractors.
Right. A very good friend of mine who was a jackal for many years with Economic Hitmen is over there now. He's made $300,000 a year. He's a professional assassin, and he's working for the U.S. government, but he's not on anybody's lists.
Yeah. Because
there's about 10,000 contractors like him there.
Yeah. And so you say that there are basically three levels or three layers that a country goes through. First of all, they send in the economic hitmen, folks like doing what you were doing. And these folks go into a country and they say, gee, you're really poor and underdeveloped here. We can build a dam here. We can build a power plant here. We can put a railroad through here. It's going to cost billions of dollars. We'll loan you that money through the World Bank or the IMF, or we'll arrange private financing through the United States. And you just have to pay us us back, you know, over a period of time, and everything will be fine because we're going to make your economy so much hotter and so much more active that you'll be able to easily pay it back. When in fact, they can't pay it back. They can never pay it back. And they end up so deeply in debt that once the debt is obvious and conspicuous, we can go in and say, you know, you're not able to pay your debt. We'll take the oil instead. That kind of thing. Is that right? That's the first level. Then if that doesn't work, if the country says, no, we don't really want to take your debt, or they take the debt and then they say, we're not going to give you the oil, even though we owe you money, then the second level goes in, and those are the jackals.
The jackals, yes.
Right. And tell us about them.
Well, the jackals are usually CIA-sanctioned, often private contractors, who may first try to overthrow our government the way Kermit Roosevelt did, the way we tried to do in Venezuela a couple of years ago with Hugo Chavez there. Or if they don't succeed in overthrowing the government, then they may assassinate the leader, as they did in Panama with Omar Torrijos, and in Ecuador with Jaime Roldos, and with Allende in Chile, and many, many others.
Yeah, the first two of those three being people you personally knew, right?
Yeah, well, my job in both Ecuador with Jaime Roldos and Panama with Omar Torrijos was to bring these men around. But they were very integritous. They wanted to do well by their poor people. They didn't want to join the system. And I was very aware, a strong motivating force for me was knowing that the jackals were in the background. I didn't want these men assassinated. I wanted to bring them around. I knew if I didn't bring them around, they were likely to be assassinated. I didn't bring them around, and they both were assassinated.
Right.
When the jackals don't succeed, and the economic hitmen haven't succeeded, then as the last resort, as in Iraq, where neither of us succeeded, the military is sent in. Our young men and women are sent in to die and to kill.
So it appears that in Iraq, we've had two levels of failure.
Yes. Twice, you know, in the 80s and also in the 90s. In the 80s, we tried to emulate what we'd done in Saudi Arabia and Iran very successfully under the Shah of Iran and very successfully with the House of Saud. We tried to emulate that in Iraq, failed, and so the jackals went in, they failed, so we sent in the military in 1990. Then we thought Saddam had been sufficiently chastised that the economic hitmen would succeed. They didn't. The jackals again failed also. So we sent the military in once again.
Yeah. Yeah. And in how many countries in the world do you estimate that we have one of these three levels? Let's break it out. How many countries in the world do you figure, first of all, that we have open military activity going on?
Oh, you know, I know there's statistics, but I don't have them on my fingertips. Oh,
seems off the top of my head it would be probably in the neighborhood of around a dozen.
I think more than that. I think we have military presence and more than that, but
yeah.
I'm not sure. But what
significant
I would say
military
is that
presence. We're significantly in Colombia. We're significantly in Peru. We're obviously in Afghanistan and Iraq. We've got, now, depending on how you argue it, you could argue South Korea.
Ecuador.
Yeah, Ecuador. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And what I would say is that any country in the world that has resources that we can consider important to us, we have economic hitmen there, and if they don't succeed, we're willing to send in the military.
So how many countries do we have economic hitmen in?
Well, every country that has resources that we covet, and there's a lot of those, but then again, there's a lot that don't, and you can look at places in Africa, terrible shame, where people are suffering horribly. They need our help, but we're not going to their rescue because there's nothing in it for us or our corporations because they don't have any resources to offer up.
Other than the potential for labor. I mean, once China doesn't want to give us their slave labor any longer, but that's a whole other discussion. And in fact, it raises the question, could it be? I mean, I have a feeling that most people who do what you did, and you talk in your book about how you did too for some time, operate on the assumption, are saying to themselves, you know, wake up in the morning, look at themselves in the mirror and say, I'm not such a bad guy. I'm going to help this country. We're going to help them to get developed. After all, the middle class of the United States didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of the result of development, and we're going to help this country get developed. Don't you think that there are, and then you say, you know, there are countries in Africa, for example, where we're not involved in development and they're having disasters. Doesn't that, I mean, there's a catch-22 in there somewhere, John.
Well, yes, Tom. I'm absolutely in favor of foreign aid and development. We ought to do a heck of a lot more of it. 24,000 people starve to death every day or die of malnutrition. 30,000 children die of curable diseases because they don't get assistance. They don't get medical assistance. We need to reach out to the world much more. the fact of the matter is our current foreign aid is totally geared toward the economic hitman idea of helping our big corporations, helping a few people, in fact, who own those big corporations, and a few rich families in the developing world. That's
yeah.
what needs to change.
But the,
you
but,
know, as I,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, John, we're not unique in that. Japan, for example, is notorious. I mean, Japan gives more foreign aid than we do on a per capita basis. And mm-hmm. in most parts of the world, they actually give more foreign aid than we do. But it's almost always predicated on the qualifier that if you take this foreign aid money, you have to use it to buy the goods and services that you're going to buy with it from Japanese companies. So it becomes a cycle.
Right.
You know, it's a, and this, you know, I'm familiar with the Japanese situation because I've read a couple of books on it. I'm assuming that most other countries in the world do this pretty, you know, essentially the same thing. What's wrong with that?
Well, it's an old model that's been around a long time, and you're right. We're not the only ones using it. We just happen to be using it the most successfully of anybody in history. We've created the first truly global empire in the history of mankind. Now, what we also know, though, history tells us that empires never last, and when they fall painfully. This one, too, will fall if we stay on this path. One of the things that saved me in this, saved my soul, if you will, is my training in shamanism, these books that I wrote on shape-shifting and so forth, and knowing that we have reached this time that's been prophesized by so many, many cultures. You've written about this.
But, John, we can't... John, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We've only got about 30 seconds left, but we can't all become shamans. What is your suggestion for... What should we be doing? What can we be doing? What should we be telling our government? For example.
Well, the end of the book, the part you haven't read, is devoted to telling people what they can do. But the most important thing is to become educated, for each one of us to get out there and do what it draws our heart to doing.
There you go.
Deeply involved. Read the last pages of the book.
I will do it, John. I will do it. I'll be finishing it up tonight. John Perkins, the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, available in bookstores all over the place. John, thanks so much for being with us. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Bonjour, my name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique! And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir!
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. If you'd like to help bring the Tom Hartman program to a radio station in your area, please let us know. We have tools to help you make that happen. For more information, go to www.tomhartman.com and click on the Bring Tom Show to Your Town link on the left side of the page. Thanks for your help in bringing uncommon sense from the radical middle to your community.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
On the ninth day of Bushmas, my president gave to me a Bill of Rights. Not for gays or blacks or free speech. Not for none of these. But for health insurance companies. On the tenth day of Bushmas, my president gave to me cheaper public schools, cloning corporate tools, teaching to the test, screwing all the rest. If they don't like our new federal standardization of their kids to work in faith-based health insurance companies.
Welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just received word from Cliff Arnebeck about what's going on. Cliff writes, this is an email that's floating around. He says, Cliff Arnebeck, by the way, of course, is the attorney for the Alliance for Democracy, who has sued George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, former Enron lobbyist and RNC chairman Ed Gillespie, and company for rigging and stealing elections, specifically in Florida. But according to Cliff, it looks like this has happened in many states. He writes, the litigation is now joined, as is the attention of the mainstream media. I had lunch with Jim Dow of the New York Times on Thursday. Russell Baker of The Nation was embedded with me in our core litigation team on Friday as we refiled the Ohio election challenge to President Bush and blasted corrupt legislation, selling out Ohio to the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, being passed by the Republican Ohio legislature. He goes on to say, we were able to file the legal challenges because the personal loans made to my litigation trust account of $36,000, which covered the cash bond required by the Ohio Supreme Court. We have a dozen or so volunteer attorneys assembling in Columbus on Monday to supplement the core group of six attorneys. We also have a stable of first-rate experts, including Wayne Madsen with direct access to CIA sources, and Clint Curtis, who designed the prototype vote hacking software being used by the Republican Party. Funds are critically needed. Contributions are fully tax deductible, in as much as we have two 501c3 organizations backing this litigation. Loans against the money already raised and being raised on the internet are also needed. And so he says, please help. I'll give you his phone number. I'm reluctant to put phone numbers out on the air, but Cliff, to the best of my knowledge, doesn't have a website right now. So his phone number is in this email, which is being circulated. So it's not like I'm telling a secret. So if you want to contribute to or help Cliff Arnebeck and the work that he's doing, give him a shout there in Columbus, Ohio. The area code 614, the telephone number 481-8416. That's area code 614-481-8416. I'll repeat that again in just a minute. That's Cliff Arnebeck. He's the lawyer in Ohio who is trying to do discovery. See, the amazing thing, and this is the reason why Bev Harris of Black Box Voting also is doing these lawsuits around the country. The amazing thing is that in virtually all of our elections, the only way to find out what really happened with these black box voting contraptions, these machines that keep no records, there's no paper trail. And in many places, in many states, in many counties, the only way to even get a comparison of paper ballots to what the machines that counted the paper ballots said the paper ballots said is through a lawsuit. Because there's such a hodgepodge of rules from state to state, and many states don't provide for the ability to recount. After Chuck Hagel was elected in Nebraska eight or ten years ago, formerly he had been the president of what is now ESNS, the largest or second largest voting machine company in the country, had sold those machines to the state of Nebraska, ran for the Senate, and miraculously defeated a popular incumbent Democratic governor, first Republican in decades to even get a seat. Anyhow, when a year after that happened, the Republican-dominated legislature in that state passed a law saying that nobody could audit the election machines. It was against the law to audit the election machines, so it requires a lawsuit. So here now we have Cliff Arnebeck actually doing this with this lawsuit. The number, area code 614-481-8416, if you want to contribute to his efforts. I think he's probably, you know, regardless of what they find, here's what's going to happen. They're either going to find out that there's nothing going on, which frankly would be a big relief, or they're going to find out something horrible went on, which frankly we need to fix. So I think regardless of your side on this issue, this is a guy that needs some support. 29 minutes past the hour.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. As Christmas approaches, 350 UAW workers and their families are locked out of work at the CNH Case New Holland plant in Racine, Wisconsin. UAW Local 180 went on strike November 2nd over health insurance and other issues, but on November 22nd they announced an end to that strike. Management, though, won't let the workers return as long as a new contract remains unsettled. Local 180's Kevin Michkowski says it's gut-wrenching for he and fellow workers to have to watch replacement workers taking their jobs at Christmas time.
When strike replacement workers came in and started working while we were on, when we called the strike, and then to see them, you know, keep those individuals in there and see the faces of my members, it's really, really a sad time to see it, you know, because they're coming in there and then doing the work that we could do.
The AFL-CIO is asking the public to support the striking families by sending donations to UAW Local 180, 3323 Kearney Avenue in Racine, Wisconsin at 53403.
The Building Trades Union recently weighed in on the discussion revolving around the restructuring of the AFL-CIO. Edward Sullivan, president of the AFL-CIO's Building and Construction Trades Department, sent a letter to AFL-CIO President John Sweeney last week. In the letter, he encourages a self-examination of labor's future. However, he says it's reckless and irresponsible for individuals outside of the construction industry to take a one-size-fits-all approach to the future of the movement. Sullivan's letter comes in response to suggestions made by the SEIU and Teamsters for the future of the AFL-CIO.
New York Times has shined a national spotlight on a possible case of racial profiling and workplace discrimination. Two Shiite Muslims, Ali Akbar Afshari and Shala Afshari, were fired for national security reasons that remain secret. The Afsharis moved to the U.S. from Iran 18 years ago, and both were employees of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, a federal agency that studies workplace hazards. Alan Carlin is the lawyer representing Mr. and Mrs. Afshari.
Suddenly, one day earlier this year, they were called in and summarily fired, escorted off the premises, given no rights, and told only that they had failed a background check that they didn't even know they were being checked out on.
The Afsharis are asking the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services for back pay and reinstatement or the chance to appeal.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Civilian satisfaction with services of the federal government reached an all-time high in 2004. According to the Customer Satisfaction Report published by the University of Michigan, the federal sector received an overall score of 72.1 out of 100. Claes Fornell, the professor who oversees the survey, said that shrinking government would make it more difficult to maintain the ranking. Courtesy and professionalism of government personnel is also at an all-time high. Health-related services continue to receive the highest scores.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You gave him the old, stay the course, I'm your man. Why, he'll flip-flop ya. He has no strength to lead. Yes, this you feared. While soldiers' jobs and surplus disappeared. Gave him the old, never yet devil speak. Yes, with folks swindled him. No one could hear the truth above the roar.
Yes. Welcome back.
Though your debating was a stinker, they bought it all, hook, line, and sinker. You razzle-dazzled them, and they gave you four more.
And welcome back, 26.
Fans aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
Welcome back. 26 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's time for our report from Washington, D.C., our daily report from the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria Jones with us today. Hey, Victoria, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
What's up?
Well, a couple of things. Presidential news conference this morning, which is a bit of a surprise. It was only announced about an hour before it happened. And then, of course, continuing fallout and the most fun topic in Washington these days, which is how many, you know, putting odds on how many days Rumsfeld has in his job.
Yeah. Well, what was the press conference about?
Well, it was wide-ranging, actually. The president was asked questions about just about everything, including the budget. He says he's going to cut the deficit in half and still maintain strict spending discipline. The Iraqi elections, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, who he says is doing a very fine job. And about Rumsfeld, he also said that people don't seem to understand him, that Rumsfeld and his wife visit troops and he's just great. And, you know, if people got to know him better, they'd feel the same way, too. Yeah, he said beneath that rough and gruff, no-nonsense demeanor is a good human being who cares deeply about the military and the grief that war causes.
Yeah, you know, I would be inclined to believe that if he hadn't done what he did back in the 70s, lying about Russian weapons of mass destruction, and then done what he did in this administration, lying about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, and then led us into war, and in the way that he did. And then you would think after just a few months, he would have said, hey, wait a minute, this strategy isn't working. I mean, we've had over 1,000 soldiers die. You'd think after the first 50 or 100 or 200 or 300 or 400 or 500 or 600, he would have gotten it.
You would think so.
I have a feeling
that just didn't happen.
Yeah, he's going to go down in history just like Robert McCormick. Or John McCormick. Was it John? Robert.
McNamara.
McNamara, thank you.
McNamara.
I'm confusing him with the guy who invented the cotton gin or something. Anyhow, yes. Oh, my. Anyway.
I love that. It's great.
Yeah. So that was...
Talking about the National Intelligence Director, he said, and this is a direct quote, I'm going to find somebody who knows something about intelligence. and capable and honest and ready to do the job.
This is because...
I like the first part of the quote.
This is because Condi Rice was incapable of reading a simple email about the threat that bin Laden represented. And so he's going to find somebody who can. I mean, you know, people are starting to read this bill now. And I'm going to be sharing some of the stuff with our listeners after we get off the phone. And there is some spooky stuff in this thing.
That's what's disturbing, because there were many recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. Most of them I supported. I'd followed the hearings pretty closely. I saw their reasoning. And now looking a little bit more closely at the bill, probably not as closely as you, I've seen how some things could be intended one way, but they're written ambiguously enough that they can be used in any number of ways.
Yeah, yeah.
such as the functions of the Director of National Intelligence.
In particular. Yeah, I mean, here now we're taking, we had this big problem with this invasion of Iraq, this illegal war against Iraq, that although the CIA was saying, hey, there's no there, and the Intelligence Service of the United Nations, Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei, were saying, there's no there. Rummy sets up his own, with Richard Perle and Fife, sets up his own intelligence service within the Pentagon and is cherry-picking information out of the CIA and stovepiping it, feeding it right up to Cheney and ultimately to Bush, without it being vetted, without the contrary information. It's called the politicization or politicalization, whatever the word is. Do you know how to pronounce that word?
Politicization.
Politicization. Thank you. The politicization of intelligence. And so to deal with this now, we have consolidated all the intelligence service and put them under the aegis of one individual who's a political appointee?
That's the problem with this. I mean, the idea of one individual, I don't necessarily have a problem with if they've got power and if they're effective and if they're impartial. Once it becomes a presidential appointee, and I don't even know if they have to go through confirmation. I don't think they do. It's not a cabinet post.
Oh, my.
Once it's a presidential appointee, and given this administration's desire to have information and intelligence that suits their agenda, then it gets a little bit disturbing.
This is the exact same thing. Well, it's not the exact same thing, but it's frighteningly close to what Hitler did when he consolidated all of the intelligence services in Germany and put them under the supervision of his good buddy. What was it? Himmler, I think, was in charge of it, the former chicken farmer. And it's just, well, anyway.
I know.
Yeah. Okay. So what else is going on in Washington?
Well, then obviously the one of the questions the president was asked about was Rumsfeld not signing letters of condolence to families of slain soldiers.
Yeah.
He kind of sidestepped that, but that issue is very much ongoing in Washington. One of the questions being asked, of course, is how come that report, if report it was, came out at this time, saying that Rumsfeld didn't sign? Obviously, he hasn't been signing for some time, but it's convenient for people perhaps in the Pentagon who might want him out that this information came up at a time when there is a building feeling against Rumsfeld.
Well, there's also an interesting question here about whether George Bush actually signs these kinds of things.
Well, we're told he does.
I know we're told he does. And you go onto the websites of some of these veteran sites, and people are starting to compare signatures and going, this looks like an auto pen to me.
And if he doesn't, and if he said he does, then it's going to come out. You can't do that anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't get away with it in this day and age.
Yeah, well, we'll see. It may be that Rummy is just so much busier. You know, he's got wars to prosecute and things to do. And George W. was able in his first 3 years in office to take more vacations than any president in the history of the United States.
Amazing, isn't it? I wish I could organize my time that way. Maybe I need to go to Harvard Business School to learn that.
There you go. Well, he is, of course, the first president who is a businessman before
there
he became
are.
President.
And yeah, does he ever make money in any of his businesses?
No.
No. Okay. No.
Sorry. Every single one failed except for the baseball team. And the way that they made money was by taking property away from people in the city of Dallas to build a stadium with taxpayer funds. And he walked away from that one with about $18 million.
So he should come to D.C. and sort out our baseball problem.
Well, maybe he already has. Who knows?
Oh, that's scary.
Yeah, there you go.
You're a scary guy.
Victoria, thanks so much for your report today.
Thank you.
It's good to hear from you. It's always
great
to hear from you. Okay, talk to you tomorrow. It's 19 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. The creation of the National Intelligence Director. People are, as I was saying with Victoria, people are starting to look at this thing and going, hey, whoa, wait a minute. Do we really expect that if a political appointee, a person who owes their job to the president and is answerable only to the president, is going to provide everybody else with any intelligence or information that might contradict what the president says? Should we really expect that? For example, the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman wrote on Thursday, this from the Center for American Progress, that the release of the third Arab Human Development Report has been delayed since October. Now, this is an official UN report. Has been delayed since October because Bush administration officials objected to portions in the prologue that criticized the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The AHDR, an independent Arabic language report that has previously called for sweeping regional pluralistic reforms, and this year addresses governance and misgovernance in the Arab world and the legal, institutional, and religious impediments to political reform. Friedman writes that the criticism of U.S. policy in the report, while heartfelt, quote, is there to give political cover to the Arab authors for a clear-eyed critique of Arab governance, which is the other 90% of the report. It's just the kind of report that could fuel the emerging debate on Arab reform, end quote. On Friday, a U.N. official confirmed Friedman's account of the delay, while U.S. State Department officials claimed they had merely made inquiries into whether or not the report would contain remarks critical of the United States. So we're going to have one guy now in charge of all of our intelligence. We're also going to have a national ID card. Let me see your papers. By federalizing driver's licenses. See, it used to be you only had to have a driver's license on you if you were going to drive. Now you've got to have it if you want to fly.
But I'm not a pilot.
Actually, I am a pilot, but you know, you get the point. Well, they'll accept passports as well, grudgingly. The Intel bill also creates a civil liberties board. It's a good analysis of this, published by the Progressive Trail by Mike Whitney, called The Enemies Among Us. The Intel bill also creates a civil liberties board charged with investigating whether the new legislation adversely affects civil rights. Regrettably, suggests Whitney, the board is a complete sham. It has no subpoena power and is subordinate to the National Intelligence Director, who in turn is subordinate to who? Or to whom? To the President and the Attorney General. In other words, it's merely a public relations ploy. The powers of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court have been expanded. I'll bet you didn't even know that there was such a court. The FISA court used to be under the Patriot Act that if you wanted to drag somebody before the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, and throw them in jail without charges or hold them without access to a lawyer or ship them down to Guantanamo or send them off to Saudi Arabia to be tortured, you had to prove that they had some affiliation with a terrorist group. It could be thin. Well, this guy goes to this mosque over here, and, you know, it could be thin. But there had to be some sort of affiliation. This is referred to as probable cause. Probable cause comes out of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. Just, you know, lays it right out. I mean, this is not, like, you know, a secret or anything. The Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause. Now, what can define probable cause? Well, it requires the testimony of somebody, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. In other words, you've got to have a warrant if you're going to come into somebody's house or you're going to drag somebody off to jail. Used to be. I mean, that's just the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. The Bush administration has said, Fourth Amendment, you're kidding, come on. No. We have Guantanamo. We have our very own concentration camp. Now, under this new Intelligence Act, this has been eliminated with what they call the lone wolf provision. Seriously, it's called the lone wolf provision. And what it does is it allows unlimited surveillance of any American without the hassle of having to prove even the remotest connection to organized terror or a foreign government. It's a blank check for law enforcement to set aside all privacy laws without fear of reprimand. The end of the Fourth Amendment. Just signed into law. You know, and I'll bet someplace out in rural Colorado, right at this moment as I'm speaking, there is some very conservative talk show host. I mean, a true, good old-fashioned, Barry Goldwater conservative talk show host, saying the same thing I'm saying right now with equal concern. It's not the old-fashioned conservatives we have to worry about, or the liberals. It's the fascists. As they say in poker, let's call a spade, not a club. If someone's arrested as a terrorist suspect, he can be refused bail and imprisoned indefinitely without charges. Now, how do you know someone's a terrorist? Well, they decide it. And prisoners will have to prove that they aren't guilty. You are now guilty until you prove you're innocent. Sure sounds like American jurisprudence has been turned upside down. What do you think, Armin? Armin in Sarasota, Florida, on the line, 1-866-889-8894.
It sounds suspect.
It sounds, yeah. Are you a suspect, Armin?
How would I know that?
Well, you keep calling in. If you're not on
well,
the list already.
Are they going to tell me when I need to exercise more and watch my weight along with me?
There you go. They may well do it. What's on your mind?
I was just going to talk about a few things, if I may. The first thing, what's the difference between a tenured economist and a corporate economist?
I hear a joke coming. What is it?
Well, I don't really know if it's a joke. It's kind of a sad joke if it is. But basically, if a tenured economist is wrong, they get to keep their tenure. And usually, if a corporate economist is wrong, not necessarily usually,
they get a job in government, in the Bush administration.
They get a golden parachute.
Ah, they get a golden parachute. But, just as close. In the case of John Snow, well, he's not an economist, he's a CEO, but they get their job in government as well. Good to hear from you, Armin, and a good joke. 10 minutes before the hour, it's a Tom Hartman radio program. Viagra for your brain.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555. And mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
This year, give a Christmas gift of inner peace, mental health, and transformation in the form of a fun, beautiful game you play with your body and brain based on meditation, breathing, and biofeedback. Go to opednews.com to click on the Wild Divine banner to order the game that Yoga Journal says turns the quest for calm into entertainment. In most games, you find weapons. With Wild Divine, you connect your computer to your body and play the game with your mind, heart, and breath. You find new abilities and awareness truly within yourself that you use to win the game and then apply in your real life. PC Magazine says Wild Divine is innovative and fun, and even better, it's very effective. And they give it 5 stars. It's shipped with both Windows and Mac software.
The Wild Divine game is a great Christmas gift that will make a real difference in a person's life. Go to opednews.com now and click on the Wild Divine banner to order it in time for Christmas. That's opednews.com.
For
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the Southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
This is a Workers' Independent News Service feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. Sometimes called the Supreme Court of Labor Relations, the National Labor Relations Board has recently made some decisions favoring employers over employees. Rebecca Miles has more.
One agency that's been chipping away at rules concerning workers' rights is the National Labor Relations Board, a board that was created in 1935 to administer the National Labor Relations Act. The act gave workers the right to form unions freely without being fired or harassed or intimidated, and provided a legal process to those wanting to form unions and get certification. However, the board only adjudicates on cases, and it has been unwilling to enforce rules or inflict penalties when abuses occur. One in three campaigns to form unions usually fail because union organizers are fired even though this is against the law.
What's happened is that the law and the board have become means which employers use to prevent unions from being able to organize.
I asked David Bacon, a labor historian and former labor union organizer, if the National Labor Relations Board was necessary if it lacked teeth.
The board this last year made two important decisions, for instance, which actually took away rights. One of them was the right to have a witness. If your employer is going to fire you or write you up, in the past, you had the right as a worker, even in a place where there was no union, you had the right to call upon one of your fellow workers to go into any meetings with your boss. And the second one is that the board is now considering a decision that says that employers cannot voluntarily recognize unions, that they must go through, that unions must go through this election process, which has gotten so skewed and so out of balance.
For the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Said the night wind to the little lamb, do you see what I see? Way up in the sky, little lamb, do you see what I see?
It's a new spy satellite. No, I'm sorry.
A star, a star. Dancing in the night with a tail as big as a kite.
Yes, Merry Christmas. Happy holidays, whatever you may be celebrating. For me, it's Christmas. It's one of my favorite holidays. It's a big deal. Anyhow, here's the good news and the bad news. The good news is this decision has been reversed, has since been reversed. Here's the bad news. And it comes in two parts. The first part, Texas Comptroller Carol Strayhorn ruled that a Denison, Texas Unitarian Universalist congregation is not a church eligible for tax-exempt status under Texas law because it does not have, quote, one system of belief, end quote. You know, this is an old joke about Unitarian Universalists. If a Unitarian was walking down a road afterlife or whatever. And and it came to a fork in the road, and one direction it said to heaven, and the other direction it said to a discussion in heaven. They would go to the discussion. It's, you know, Unitarians think that's a very funny joke, by the way. The Unitarian Universalist pastor has reacted with shock, noting that two U.S. presidents, John Adams and John Quincy Adams, were both Unitarian Universalists. Unitarian Universalists do not consider themselves Christian, by the way. And in fact, many Unitarian Universalists even consider the issue of whether or not there's a God to be an open question. And thus, Carol Strayhorn had ruled that the Denison, Texas Unitarian Universalist Church was not a church. Well, and she vows to persist in her practice until ordered to stop by the U.S. Supreme Court because the very integrity of religion is at stake. So Unitarians don't get to have a church, but the Satan worshippers who have a who believe in God and do believe in a one system of belief, they can. Well, that's okay. That's half the bad news. The other half of the bad news is before you dismiss Comptroller Strayhorn as some out of touch wingnut with no influence beyond the borders of Texas, consider her youngest son, Scott McClellan, is press secretary to the President of the United States, while her eldest son, Dr. Mark McClellan, is the United States Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. Yes, indeed, it's the Tom Hartman radio program where being progressive never felt so good.
Been listening to the Tom Hartman program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. As Christmas approaches, 350 UAW workers and their families are locked out of work at the CNH Case New Holland plant in Racine, Wisconsin. UAW Local 180 went on strike November 2nd over health insurance and other issues, but on November 22nd they announced an end to that strike. Management, though, won't let the workers return as long as a new contract remains unsettled. Local 180's Kevin Michkowski says it's gut-wrenching for he and fellow workers to have to watch replacement workers taking their jobs at Christmas time.
When strike replacement workers came in and started working while we were on, when we called the strike, and then to see them, you know, keep those individuals in there and see the faces of my members, it's really, really a sad time to see it, you know, because they're coming in there and then doing the work that we could do.
The AFL-CIO is asking the public to support the striking families by sending donations to UAW Local 180, 3323 Kearney Avenue in Racine, Wisconsin at 53403.
The Building Trades Union recently weighed in on the discussion revolving around the restructuring of the AFL-CIO. Edward Sullivan, president of the AFL-CIO's Building and Construction Trades Department, sent a letter to AFL-CIO President John Sweeney last week. In the letter, he encourages a self-examination of labor's future. However, he says it's reckless and irresponsible for individuals outside of the construction industry to take a one-size-fits-all approach to the future of the movement. Sullivan's letter comes in response to suggestions made by the SEIU and Teamsters for the future of the AFL-CIO.
New York Times has shined a national spotlight on a possible case of racial profiling and workplace discrimination. Two Shiite Muslims, Ali Akbar Afshari and Shala Afshari, were fired for national security reasons that remained secret. The Afsharis moved to the U.S. from Iran 18 years ago, and both were employees of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, a federal agency that studies workplace hazards. Alan Carlin is the lawyer representing Mr. and Mrs. Afshari.
Suddenly, one day earlier this year, they were called in and summarily fired, escorted off the premises, given no rights, and told only that they had failed a background check that they didn't even know they were being checked out on.
The Afsharis are asking the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services for back pay and reinstatement or the chance to appeal.
Here's today's Dawabab Report. Civilian satisfaction with services of the federal government reached an all-time high in 2004. According to the Customer Satisfaction Report published by the University of Michigan, the federal sector received an overall score of 72.1 out of 100. Claes Fornell, the professor who oversees the survey, says that shrinking government would make it more difficult to maintain the ranking. Courtesy and professionalism of government personnel is also at an all-time high. Health-related services continue to receive the highest scores.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
No, not the yacht.
Darling, wake up. You're having a nightmare.
Oh, it was terrible. Oh. I dreamed we lost our billions, and we were middle class.
There, there.
We were both working, and we could barely pay our bills. The children had to go to public schools. Oh. We had something called an HMO.
Oh, you poor thing.
It seems so real. We couldn't even afford my Botox.
Oh, sweetheart, go back to sleep. I'll write another campaign check tomorrow.
President George W. Bush, keeping alive the American dream for some of us.
Easily paid for by BillionairesForBush.com.
Time for another peek into the lifestyles of the rich and cranky. Being rich really can be tough. Yes, you do get lots of stuff. Houses, cars, gadgets, games, gizmos, and other toys to keep you amused as you idle away your time. But then, you have all that stuff to deal with. Just keeping it dusted must be taxing. And of course, you keep buying more stuff because, well, you're rich. You can afford it. But then, you have more to deal with and, ah, what's a rich person to do? Of course, do what regular people do. Have a yard sale. This is precisely the solution that Caroline Kennedy came upon when she realized that she simply had too much stuff. In her own words, "I found myself again with more houses and belongings than I could possibly use or enjoy." Yes, Caroline, we can only imagine what a burden that must be. So, she's having a yard sale. Not literally, for wealthy neighbors would find it tacky beyond belief for the Kennedys to display their castaways on the lawn of the family compound at Hyannis Port. No, no, this will be done properly. An elite New York City auction house will handle the February sale of Caroline's stuff. And it is mostly just stuff. For sure, there are some special items and rare family photos of John F. Kennedy, but the bulk of the lot is much like what you'd put out for your yard sale. A fiberglass kitchen tray, some duck decoys, pieces and bits of a set of plain dinner dishes, a few dinged-up end tables, a pair of folding suitcase racks, and, get this, a bunch of mason jars. But while it is just stuff, it is Kennedy stuff. So Caroline's yard sale is expected to fetch a minimum of $1 million. Indeed, a special 380-page catalog of her stuff has been printed, and the catalog itself is tagged at $50 a copy. This is Jim Hightower saying, maybe the Kennedys need the money, but really, shouldn't she just have donated some of this stuff to Goodwill?
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
1 in 4 adults has high blood pressure. If you're one of them and you have a cold, Coricidin HBP has surprising news for you. The American Heart Association recognizes that decongestants found in many leading cold medicines can raise your blood pressure and interfere with blood pressure medication. So why risk it? Only decongestant-free Coracetin HBP provides a line of safe, powerful cold and flu medication specially formulated for people with high blood pressure. So make the safe choice. Coracetin HBP. Use as directed.
Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Are we smack down the right-wing nut jobs with one hemisphere? No. It's too close. I'm sorry. Welcome back. The United for Peace and Justice, www.unitedforpeace.org is their website. United for Peace and Justice is launching a white ribbon campaign. Now, you can on the one hand, go out and buy a magnetic yellow ribbon for your car, manufactured in China, to support our U.S. troops defending America and our American way of life. Manufactured in China. But the problem is that, a lot of folks who really do support our troops, I support our troops. I absolutely support our troops. And in fact, a very close friend of mine is leaving 3 days after Christmas for Iraq as a member of the National Guard. He's going to be stationed about 15 miles north of Iraq. Of Baghdad. I support our troops. I don't support the war. I don't support the invasion of Iraq. It was a horrible mistake. In fact, I would go beyond mistake. I would say it was a crime committed by the Bush administration, organized by the neocons and by Karl Rove. The timing of it specifically defined by Karl Rove. To help George W. Bush get reelected as president, because they, as Rove pointed out, you can read about this in Woodward's book, as Rove pointed out, no sitting president during time of war has ever failed to get reelected in the history of the United States. So you get a good war going, and, Afghanistan just rolled over too fast. And they didn't want to have the same problem that George Sr. had with his 100-hour war. And George W. Jr. looked at that and said, if Daddy had only kept that war going for another couple months, he would have been president for a second term. And he was right. So anyhow, a lot of folks want to support our troops by suggesting that we should bring them home. And, frankly, I have to say, I think that given how things are going there, I hope that the folks in the administration, even though they aren't saying it out loud, are thinking the same thing, that, the quicker they can get these folks, the quicker they can get our troops out of there, the better. It's just a crime that they had to go in the first place. But anyhow, so United for Peace and Justice is suggesting white ribbons. White ribbons. British peace and justice allies used white ribbons to symbolize opposition to the war back in 2003, before we invaded. And in fact, this white ribbon had become part of an international symbol of opposition to the United States invasion of Iraq. And so the suggestion is that, how about white ribbons? Why don't we get white ribbons instead of yellow ribbons and use those? So, I think this is a great idea. So far as I know, they are not yet making the white ribbons in China. So what they suggest is that you can go out and you can get your own fabric and you can make your own ribbon. You just stop in a fabric store and say, I'd like a little bit of white ribbon. In fact, nowadays you can buy them in drugstores and things because you use them to wrap gifts with and tape it on your car, put it on your lapel or whatever. Or buy a yellow ribbon and paint it white. I don't know. So something worth checking out. Michael Hoffman, who spent 2 months with the Marines. This is McCall.com. If you have one of those magnetic support, he has a different take on it. He says, if you have one of those magnetic support our troop ribbons on your car, he suggests you grab a marker and add the words, bring them home now. This is a 25-year-old Marine veteran of the Iraq War who is the co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War. This is an organization that's only 5 months old, and the membership is only for veterans of the Iraqi War. Wants immediate withdrawal of all forces, occupation forces from Iraq, real reconstruction aid for that country, and properly and funded and administered veterans benefits. So that's another take on it. By the way, on this program, last week, I think it was, a week ago Thursday, we had on PMH Atwater as our Everything You Know Is Wrong guest. And a listener says, and PMH Atwater apparently made a reference to Susan Blackmore, a woman who has written on death and dying issues. And she said something to the effect of that Susan Blackmore had retracted her positions. And Blackmore, in fact, here, this email, I asked for an email that actually had the quotes. I've been unable to get this has just been a mess. Anyhow, this person who emailed me, whose name is not on this email, said, I asked Susan Blackmore, quote, I was listening to a radio program that had PMH Atwater as a guest who said that you recently denounced what Dying to Live proposes. Is this true? End quote. Again, Dying to Live is her book on OBES and NDES. And she responded with no. Some of the details may have changed a little, and we know a lot more about how OBEs come about, but my basic argument is just the same and more securely based on evidence, too. End quote. So, hopefully that, whatever, if there was a bit of misinformation conveyed about Ms. Blackmore, my apologies. It was conveyed by my guest, and I, frankly, that's the end of that. Group wants town meeting to weigh in on anti-war resolution. Peter Hirschfield, this is a local Vermont story, but again, this is the sort of thing. These kind of things are happening all over the country. Calling the war in Iraq a quintessentially local issue, an activist group is looking to the quintessentially local government forum, town meeting, to spark a discussion it hopes will lead to the return of Vermont's National Guard from the Middle East. Speaking of the National Guard, it calls for Vermont's congressional delegation. That would be Pat, Bernie, and good old Jim. Pat Leahy, Bernie Sanders, and Jim Jeffords. Calls for Vermont's congressional delegation to urge Congress to return power over the National Guard to the individual states the Guard was designed to protect. Gee, how quickly we forget. Why do we have a National Guard? To protect the individual states and to protect the borders of the nation, to the extent that the National Guard is an extension of the militia. It calls for Vermont's congressional delegation to urge Congress to return power over the National Guard to the individual states. Resolution drafters cite a 1986 bill that handed over authority of the Guard to the president, effectively eliminating state control over military battalions originally created for use in state crises at state leaders' discretion. Chapter 2, Section 59 of the Vermont Constitution, resolution drafters say, gives the state the authority to withhold Guard troops if it can demonstrate that sending them abroad will unduly compromise the state's ability to handle state crises. So, is the National Guard in your state AWOL? That is AWOL with the absent without the leave of the state. You know, there is a reason why we have National Guards. We have disasters. We have earthquakes and floods and hurricanes. And the National Guard comes out and helps out. Back in the 70s, we had riots even. Osama bin Laden has been making the same claims that the conservatives have been making since the Reagan era. One of the favorite claims of right-wing talk radio. And that is that claiming responsibility for the fall of the Soviet Union. This is one of the greatest con jobs I'll tell you, in the 1960s, the CIA was saying the Soviet Union is going down the toilet. You know, ask anybody who visited. I was there. I visited Russia. I was in East Berlin. I was in Hungary. It was a mess. It was an absolute mess. I wrote a whole chapter, actually, about a visit to Russia in a book that I wrote called The Prophet's Way. It was a disaster. It did. Their economic system didn't work. State planning didn't work. The control of the means of distribution and production, that's the definition of socialism, didn't work. At least the definition of that style of socialism didn't work. The country was going down the tubes. And that's why Nixon in 72 declared detente. He sent Kissinger over and they cut a deal. And Kissinger comes back and Nixon holds a press conference and says, the age of fear is over. Get it? The age of fear is over. No more need to be afraid. Well, that was 72. 2 years later, Nixon's out on his butt into the Watergate thing. And Gerry Ford is president. And Gerry Ford brings in his chief of staff. Haldeman and Ehrlichman are gone now, right? And McNamara is gone. He brings in his chief of staff and his secretary of defense, Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld. Yeah, you heard me right. And Don Rumsfeld, as Secretary of Defense in the Gerry Ford administration, decides we can't have the age of fear over. And he starts going on and on and on about how there are these weapons of mass destruction that the Soviet Union has. And the CIA comes out and, to quote a CIA report talking about Rumsfeld, lives in a fantasy world. And the CIA comes out and says, no, sorry. And Rumsfeld knows, no, they're there. The fact that you can't see them proves that they're there. The CIA says, well, we have no evidence that they're there. Rumsfeld says, see, I told you so. And Rumsfeld gets this whole thing all wanked up, and he gets Reagan all freaked out. And so Reagan is like, you know, okay, we need to give a few $1 billion to our buddies at Bechtel and Raytheon and whatnot, you know, Star Wars. Let's start pumping money into these corporations that Don Rumsfeld later went to work for as a lobbyist, by the way, before he came into the Bush 2 administration. And we spent ourselves nearly into bankruptcy, and the Soviet Union fell, just like the CIA had predicted. And, of course, now all the cons run around and say, see, Reagan outspent them. Reagan could have slept through his entire 8 years, and the Soviet Union would have still fallen. In fact, he did sleep through much of it, but the CIA still would have fallen. Rumsfeld's hysterical things about Soviet WMDs, which, by the way, after the Soviet Union fell, we discovered were all wrong. When we went in looking for those WMDs after the end of the Soviet Union, they weren't there. They did not have a submarine satellite detection or detection system that did not use sonar. They had none of that stuff. It wasn't there. Well, anyhow, Osama bin Laden is now making the same claim. He's saying that he bled Russia for 10 years until it went bankrupt. When will it end? 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
This year,
give a Christmas gift of inner peace, mental health, and transformation in the form of a fun, beautiful game you play with your body and brain based on meditation, breathing, and biofeedback. Go to opednews.com to click on the Wild Divine banner to order the game that Yoga Journal says turns the quest for calm into entertainment. In most games, you find weapons. With Wild Divine, you connect your computer to your body and play the game with your mind, heart, and breath. So you find new abilities and awareness truly within yourself that you use to win the game and then apply in your real life. PC Magazine says Wild Divine is innovative and fun, and even better, it's very effective. And they give it 5 stars. It's shipped with both Windows and Mac software.
The Wild Divine game is a great Christmas gift that will make a real difference in a person's life. Go to opednews.com now and click on the Wild Divine banner to order it in time for Christmas. That's opednews.com. If you sell a product or service, we have listeners from coast to coast and in 97 countries who want to know about you. Reach out to our national audience with our small business advertising package. You'll pay just a fraction of what national advertising usually costs. Call now at 802-229-2288 or visit our website, tomhartmann.com, and follow the links to the small business advertising package for more information. Don't miss reaching a national audience now. 802-229-2288. Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartmann.
I love my country so much, man. Like an exasperating friend. Dum 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 dum. Move on, move on. Dum dum.
Welcome back. Time for an electile dysfunction report. Electile. Yes, that's the word I said. Electile.
Welcome, my son. Welcome to machine.
In just the past 6 months, according to a new report from Common Cause, the makers of these electronic voting machines say have spent $375,000 on lobbying. For just one state. In just one state. In just one state. In the state of New York. In New York State. In just one state. In just 6 months. Rachel Leon, executive director of Common Cause New York, said the spending is likely just the tip of the iceberg because lobbyists only have to report spending aimed at influencing legislation, not the lobbying of state agencies such as the Board of Elections. Just 1 month. Just one state. Just 6 months. Leon said she expected the lobbying expenditures by the voting machine companies to top $1 million before the end of the year. In one state. this is apparently a very profitable business. The Common Cause Report, based on spending through October of this year, shows the heaviest outlays coming from two major players in the voting machine business, Diebold Election Systems, $275,000, and Sequoia Voting Systems, $265,771. Now, this just in one state. In just 6 months. Other reported spending comes from ES&S, Election Systems and Software, Chuck Hagel's old company, $159,319. Danaher Controls, $58,500. Liberty Election Systems, $48,635. AccuPoll, $42,283. And Voting Machine Service Center, $5,000. Just the tip of the iceberg, they say. Just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, they point out that this is only on lobbying efforts specifically directed at the legislators, state lobbying efforts. And, in fact, the overall expenditures may have been much higher. Now, what's at stake? New York is going to get $100 million in federal funds to help buy new machines under the Help America Vote Act. And these companies all want a piece of that action. But there's something bizarre and unseemly in my mind about this, about these companies coming out and saying, yeah, well, we're going to provide just, you know, wonderful things here. We're going to help you voting machines and this and that and the other thing. And by the way, we don't want to tell you what's going on with them. Billy in Santa Cruz is on the line with us. Hey, Billy, what's on your mind today?
Happy holidays and season's greetings to you.
Thank you, Billy. Yes, thank you.
Now, I did something. I just insulted a large segment of our country today with that, with what I just said to you. You know that, don't you?
Well, you know, it's not what happens to you. It's how you respond to what happens to you, in my opinion.
But because I didn't say Merry Christmas,
well,
a lot of people would boycott me. Are you?
It's not a lot of people. You know, a small handful of right-wing cranks who are trying to demagogue an issue into political power would get upset with you. That's it.
In fact, that's true. There is a group who want to boycott stores like Federated Department Stores that don't say Merry Christmas. If you say Happy Holidays or Season Greetings,
yeah,
we are urging Christians like us to boycott you.
Yeah, but it's a very small group. It has gotten it so out of proportion to the reality. The vast majority of Americans have no problem with this. This is just nuts. It's absolutely nuts. But, you know, you raise a point, Billy, and we've talked about it before. And great to hear from you. It's always great to hear from you. And I appreciate it. 29 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where liberals fiendishly plot for total world domination 5 days a week, 3 hours a day.
We're sorry. Your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please hang up.
Having a hard time connecting with someone who cares? Try the Boys Town National Hotline at 1-800-448-3000. They'll be there to help you when you need it the most, 24 hours a day. They'll even pay for the call. Simply call 1-800-448-3000.
Boys Town National Hotline. How can I help?
Time furnished by the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. As Christmas approaches, 350 UAW workers and their families are locked out of work at the CNH Case New Holland plant in Racine, Wisconsin. UAW Local 180 went on strike November 2nd over health insurance and other issues, but on November 22nd they announced an end to that strike. Management, though, won't let the workers return as long as a new contract remains unsettled. Local 180's Kevin Michkowski says it's gut-wrenching for he and fellow workers to have to watch replacement workers taking their jobs at Christmas time.
When strike replacement workers came in and started working while we were on, when we called the strike. And then to see them, you know, keep those individuals in there and see the faces of my members, it's really, really a sad time to see it, you know, because they're coming in there and then doing the work that we could do.
The AFL-CIO is asking the public to support the striking families by sending donations to UAW Local 180, 3323 Kearney Avenue in Racine, Wisconsin at 53403.
The Building Trades Union recently weighed in on the discussion revolving around the restructuring of the AFL-CIO. Edward Sullivan, president of the AFL-CIO's Building and Construction Trades Department, sent a letter to AFL-CIO President John Sweeney last week. In the letter, he encouraged a self-examination of labor's future. However, he says it's reckless and irresponsible for individuals outside of the construction industry to take a one-size-fits-all approach to the future of the movement. Sullivan's letter comes in response to suggestions made by the SEIU and Teamsters for the future of the AFL-CIO.
New York Times has shined a national spotlight on a possible case of racial profiling and workplace discrimination. Two Shiite Muslims, Ali Akbar Afshari and Shala Afshari, were fired for national security reasons that remained secret. The Afsharis moved to the U.S. from Iran 18 years ago, and both were employees of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, a federal agency that studies workplace hazards. Alan Carlin is the lawyer representing Mr. and Mrs. Afshari.
Suddenly, one day earlier this year, they were called in and summarily fired, escorted off the premises, given no rights, and told only that they had failed a background check that they didn't even know they were being checked out on.
The Afsharis are asking the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services for back pay and reinstatement or the chance to appeal.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Civilian satisfaction with services of the federal government reached an all-time high in 2004. According to the Customer Satisfaction Report published by the University of Michigan, the federal sector received an overall score of 72.1 out of 100. Claes Fornell, the professor who oversees the survey, says that shrinking government would make it more difficult to maintain the ranking. Courtesy and professionalism of government personnel is also at an all-time high. Health-related services continue to receive the highest scores.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Iraq is the front in the war against terror. Might be because we invited them there. Perhaps there's some terrible clerical error. Maybe a faulty equation. Like 9-1-1 equals U.S. invasion.
And welcome back. Yeah, this is Bin Laden, as I said before, and I really, this point, Bin Laden is as deluded as Limbaugh. I gotta say, and they both have the same delusion, and that is that somehow somebody brought about the end of the Soviet Empire by virtue of outspending them. The Soviets could not feed their own people. In the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, they could not feed their own people. They were diverting all this money into their military. And their space program and things, you know, and you say, well, yeah, they were trying to compete with us. Well, yeah, to some extent, but that isn't what did it, ultimately. That is not what did it. What did it was the system was simply unsustainable. And Bin Laden is running around now, this new tape that just came out, this new Bin Laden tape, saying, and I quote, his Afghan Mujahideen bled Russia for 10 years until it went bankrupt, end quote. And then, according to this Associated Press story, taunting the U.S. government over the size of its budget deficit, which peaked at $413 billion last year. Now Bin Laden is saying, okay, that he brought down the Soviet Union, and now he's going to bring down the United States. No, seriously. I mean, he's actually making this claim. He brought down the Soviet Union, and now he's going to bring us down the same way by bleeding us dry. Well, you know, there is some truth to the fact that the war in Iraq, which Bin Laden had nothing to do with, is costing us a lot of money. I don't see how bin Laden can claim any credit for the war in Iraq, since bin Laden wasn't in Iraq. Saddam Hussein hated bin Laden. Bin Laden wanted to overthrow Hussein. In fact, that's the reason bin Laden left Saudi Arabia, was because the Saudi royal family refused to allow him to organize a private army that he was willing to fund on the Saudi-Iraqi border and invade Iraq. He wanted to do it. The Saudis said no. He says, no, I'm going to do it. He was going to pull together a bunch of people to go with him and do it. He was going to do it in defiance of the Saudi government, and they kicked him out of the country. That's when he went to the Sudan. Eventually, the Sudanese kicked him out of that country, too. He said, enough of this guy. So we went to Afghanistan. And then after 9/11, we said to Afghanistan, we would like that guy. We have plans for him. And the Afghan government said, well, we're concerned that if we give him to the United States, he won't get a fair trial, but we'll give him to anybody else. And we may even be willing to give him to you under certain conditions. And at that point, George W. said, you know, it's much more popular for a president to be a war president than to be a negotiating president. So, anyhow, here we have the Al-Qaeda leader cites the experience of Afghan Mujahideen fighters in using guerrilla warfare and the war of attrition to fight tyrannical superpowers to drive the Soviets out. Of course, he ignores the fact that we help fund that. And it's just this bizarre logic, just this absolutely bizarre logic. Where do they get off of this stuff? Here's a scary, concerns me as we get to the real issue that I wanted to talk about here. And that is, what is going on here with Zarqawi, this guy that appears to be the new bin Laden in Iraq, killing our people, killing civilians, beheading people, blah, blah, blah. First of all, before we get to that, a poll of Americans shows that half of Americans, now this presumably are Americans who don't have relatives who lived through 1933 when they used to put German company stickers in the windows of stores that were not owned by Jews and spray stars and put stars of David in the windows of stores that were Jewish owned. Presumably these are Americans who don't remember that, maybe never knew about it, didn't bother to study it in history class, had no relation to it. Nearly half of all Americans believe the U.S. government should restrict the civil liberties of Muslim Americans. And we're not talking about immigrants to America. We're not talking about foreigners who are here on a visa or even illegally. We're talking about Americans who happen to be members of a religion, Islam, according to a nationwide poll. This poll was conducted by Cornell University, this is similar to one that was conducted by Cornell in 2002. Boy, at that time it stood at 90%. Now it's down to about half. This is a rather startling, shall we say. Republicans and people who describe themselves as highly religious were more apt to support curtailing Muslim civil liberties than Democrats or people who are less religious. Respondents who paid more attention to television news were more likely to fear terrorist attacks and support limiting the rights of Muslim Americans. 27% of respondents supported requiring all Muslim Americans to register where they lived with the government. This is what they do with sex offenders. This is what they do with felons, people who just got out of prison. Oh, let's do it with Muslims, too. I'm sure there are those in Germany who would like to start doing it with the few remaining Jews left there as well, right? This is scary. This is right here in the United States of America. Cornell student researchers questioned 715 people in a nationwide poll conducted this fall. The margin of error was 3.6 points, 3.6%. Now, in the midst of this, why would so Americans be so frantic about this? Well, there is a conspiracy theory, shall we call it, a concern. It's been out for actually a while. This dates back almost 2 years. When Abu Musab al-Zarqawi first appeared in Iraq, there were folks who were saying, you know, this guy is really not who they say he is. He's a manufactured person. And there's maybe a real guy with that name, but he's not some criminal mastermind who can be in two places at once. When you're not anywhere at all, to quote the Firesign Theater. But according to some researchers, from 2 years ago, New Dawn magazine ran this piece. According to some researchers, if Zarqawi didn't exist, the U.S. government would have to invent him. In fact, it's increasingly possible they did invent him. According to Mustafa Alani, a Gulf-based terrorism expert, quote, Zarqawi might be someone invented by politicians in the security services to point the finger blame at, end quote. Not only has his presence in Iraq never been convincingly proven, but even his whereabouts has never been corroborated by anyone other than American generals who prefer to bomb first and look later. They go on to say the U.S. State Department has increased their reward for his arrest from 10 to 25 million, which puts him on par value with bin Laden. Since early 2004, he's been in the news almost on a daily basis. Well, this wasn't from 2002. I got their dates wrong. Okay, this is a newer piece. Since early 2004, Zarqawi has been in the news almost on a daily basis. In contrast to Osama bin Laden, Zarqawi has no family history, and he supposedly comes from an impoverished Palestinian family in Jordan. His parents are dead. He emerged out of the blue. He's described by CNN as a lone wolf who is said to act independent of al-Qaeda. He seems to be in several places at the same time. He's described as the chief U.S. enemy, a master of disguise and bogus identification. We're led to believe that this lone wolf manages to outwit the powerful U.S. intelligence operatives. We're told Zarqawi's group is composed of many foreign fighters, but this claim, which underlies the misinformation foreigners are directing the Iraqi resistance, is also unsupported by the evidence. USA Today admits, quote, suspected foreign fighters account for less than 2% of the 5,700 captives being held as security threats in Iraq, a strong indication that Iraqis are largely responsible for the stubborn insurgency. The figures also suggest that Iraq isn't as big a magnet for foreign terrorists as some administration critics have asserted. Only 2% of all the people we've arrested in Iraq have been from outside Iraq. An article for the Iraqi resistance website, okay, take this with a huge grain of salt, Al-Moharar by Hana Kalandi, says, the story of Zarqawi is another invention. It's a creation of the Bush administration. Unfortunately, it found wide acceptance in the Western media. This lie was formulated to justify the American aggression in Iraq. Yada, yada, yada. The resistance in Iraq is not Zarqawi. Neither is it made up of thugs and foreigners, but genuine Iraqis. Well, the evidence seems to be that that, at least, is the case. By focusing everything on Zarqawi, this back to the story, the media is diverting attention away from the fact that every major city and town in Iraq, including large chunks of Baghdad, are now no-go areas for the occupation forces. Unwilling to admit that what is really happening in Iraq is a national uprising against the occupation, they have no other choice but to create an alternate reality with the invaluable assistance of the mass media. This article. Well, at the same time now, Scott Ritter. Yes, that's Scott Ritter, the weapons inspector, the one who was the weapons inspector working for Clinton, well, working for the UN during the Clinton administration, spent years in Iraq, blew up tons and tons and tons of Saddam's weapon stockpiles, and now is saying something startlingly similar. For months now, writes Ritter, the Bush administration has been building up the image of a massive network of foreign terrorists using Fallujah as a base for their terror attacks against targets associated with the interim government of Iyad Alawi and the U.S. military, which backs him. One name appeared in Western media accounts over and over again, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a wanted Jordanian turned, allegedly, terror mastermind. Almost overnight, Zarqawi's terrorist group, Al-Qaeda Holy War for Iraq, extended its operations across the width and breadth of Iraq. Al-Zarqawi was everywhere, his bombers striking in Mosul, Baghdad, Samarra, Najaf, Baqaba, Ramadi, and Fallujah. Islamist websites published accounts of al-Zarqawi's actions in the Western media, together with Western intelligence services, ran with these stories, giving them credibility. The al-Zarqawi legend, if one can call it that, was born. The problem is, writes Scott Ritter, there is simply no substance to this lesson, as U.S. Marines are now finding out. Rather than extremist foreign fighters battling to the death, the Marines are mostly finding local men from Fallujah who are fighting to defend their city from what they view as an illegitimate occupier. That would be us. The motivations of these fighters may be anti-American, but they are Iraqi, not foreign in origin. Ritter goes on to point out the U.S.-led assault on Fallujah may go down in history as the tipping point for the defeat of the U.S. occupation of Iraq. That would be a true tragedy. Just, you know, an ill-conceived war, lied our way into it, run badly, sent our soldiers over without appropriate body armor, without appropriate vehicles, planned the thing wrong, bad intelligence, sucked into it by the Iranians, and now this. In fact, Ritter says, reflecting back, one cannot help but wonder if al-Zarqawi was used as a lure to trap the Americans into taking this action. Whoa. According to these sources, the selection of al-Zarqawi as a front for these actions was almost too easy. Basically, what he's saying here, I'm not going to read you this whole article, but basically what he says is that the first article was, you know, suggesting that Zarqawi was invented by the U.S. Disinformation services, the U.S. intelligence service, the Pentagon, to cause Americans to think that there is that foreign terrorists are running the show, the anti-American show in Iraq, and that the Iraqis still love us. When in fact, almost all the people who are fighting against us are Iraqis. They view themselves as the patriots, Iraqi nationalists. And there's an element large element of truth to that, as you can see in the statistics of, you know, who's getting killed where and who's getting captured where. But they're suggesting that Zarqawi was invented out of whole cloth or elevated to anti-sainthood by the Americans. Ritter is suggesting that the Mukhabarat, which is the Iraqi CIA, Saddam Hussein's secret intelligence service, was the one that has created the Zarqawi myth. Isn't this interesting? And now he's saying, having created this giant, the Mukhabarat may not be able to control it. The real danger in Iraq is not the inevitable defeat of the United States, the interim government of Ayatollahi, but the fact that the longer it takes for the United States to realize victory cannot be achieved, the more emboldened the Islamists become. Now, the Mukhabarat is not in favor of the Islamists. They're secularists. And so whether we created it or whether these folks who would like to see Saddam back in power, or the Ba'athists, whether or not it's Saddam, they want, you know, the Sunnis, basically, who want secular power again and, you know, just to hold off the Shiites, that by creating this guy and making him an anti-hero within the country, he's becoming a hero within the country, and he's part of the religious right. The Shia religious right. And he's becoming a hero to them. And this may come back to bite us in the butt and the Mukhabara. What a mess. What a mess. Fascinating, but what a mess. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bonjour. My name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, and I will send you three of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
This is a Workers Independent News Service feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. According to the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, harassment of teenagers in the workplace is on the rise. The D.C. Radio Co-op's Selena Musuta reports.
When I was 17 years old, I worked at Steak and Shake in St. Louis, Missouri, and there I was subjected to unwanted sexual harassment. I complained many, many times to my main manager.
Stories like Amanda Nichols, now a sophomore in college, worry staff at the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or EEOC. Especially according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are 7 million people ages 16 to 19 that are in the labor force. This has led the EEOC to design a Youth at Work initiative to raise awareness among teenagers about their job rights. The EEOC, which turns 40 next summer, is a government agency that enforces federal laws prohibiting workplace discrimination on the basis of race, color, sex, religion, age, or disability. Since stories like Nichols are increasingly being reported to the EEOC, the EEOC has filed 40 lawsuits related to teen harassment since 2002. More than half of those lawsuits involve the service industry, says Naomi Earp, vice chair of the EEOC.
What we have is anecdotal data that indicates teens working in certain industries, including fast food, retail, and entertainment, are probably more likely to be discriminated against in some form of fashion, or of which harassment is one, than other teens working in an office, for example.
In the last 6 months, Jack in the Box, Blockbuster, and Heather's Hospitalities have been a few of the businesses that the EEOC has filed litigation against involving teenage employees. Amanda Nichols' case is still pending. For Workers Independent News Service, I am Selena Masuta of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
On the fifth day of Bushmas, my president gave to me a stop to the START treaty so we could be legal building Star Wars 2 to defend our lack of a democracy. On the sixth day of Bushmas, my president gave to me stock market tips to replace Social Security. On the seventh day of Bushmas, my president gave to me faith-based initiatives to replace Social Security.
Another one.
On the eighth day of Bushmas, my president gave to me drills for the Arctic, water laced with arsenic. Oil won't mix with water, but oil and government oughta in a centrifuge, which we'll set up in a wildlife refuge.
And welcome back. Just to wrap this thing up, the insurgency is working, three agencies warn Bush. This from a night. This is not my headline. This is a Knight Ridder headline. The CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the State Department have warned President Bush that the United States and its Iraqi allies are not winning the battle against Iraqi insurgents who are trying to derail the country's January 30th elections, according to administration officials. According to administration officials. The officials agreed to speak only on condition of anonymity because intelligence estimates are classified and because they're afraid that their wives will be outed by Scooter Libby and Dick Cheney. Said the battle in Iraq was not lost and that successful elections might yet be held next month. But they said the warnings, including one delivered this week to Bush by CIA Director Porter Goss, indicated the U.S. forces had not been able to stop the insurgents' intimidation of Iraqi voters, their intimidation of Iraqi candidates, and their intimidation of others who want to participate in the elections. We don't have an answer to the intimidation, one senior official said. Nor have the United States and the interim Iraqi government been able to find any divisions that they can exploit to divide and conquer the Sunni Muslim insurgency, the intelligence reports say. Well, my solution to this is very simple. Let's go back to the Ottoman Empire days. This is like just pre-1918. And say there are really three, they were states. They were states of Turkey at the time. But there's three states here, and either have them as independent states, so you have a federal republic like the United States, where you have a weak central government and strong states, or, and strong states' rights, separated into three separate nations, Kurdistan, Sunni land and Shia land or whatever. Now, the problem with that is that once you give the Kurds autonomy, Turkey will go ballistic. I mean, it would be a meltdown. And Turkey is just now trying to get itself into the European Union and all this sort of stuff. And Turkey's got its own problems with their Kurds. And they should free their Kurds, too, by the way, in my opinion. But this, ultimately, I think, is going to be the only solution. Otherwise, we're going to end up with a Shia-controlled Iraq buddying with Iran, and we are going to have a bigger mess than we ever imagined. Well, that's one solution. Tom Hartman here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug? The phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people...